Open the pod bay doors, Hal.
I'm sorry, Dave. I'm afraid I can't do that.
Listen to them. Children of the night. What music, Dave.
What an excellent day for an exorcism.
You wouldn't be able to do these awful things to me if I weren't still in this chair.
But you are, Blanche. You are in that chair.
Who's in the box?
Put the gun down, baby.
No, what's in the box?
I said you give me the
what's
gun.
What's in the box?
Wolves have a territorial range of about 300 miles and a kill range of 30. If we're close to their den, and if we're within that radius, then they'll come after us. How can we tell if we're close? We can't.
What in God's name are you talking about?
Your son, Mr. Thorne. The son of the devil.
They're insane.
He must die, Mr. Thorne!
Do not want to go that way.
What's that way?
Officer, sir, you do not want to go that way. We're going to the mall.
Hello, Dexter Morgan.
Hello, welcome once again to Dark Discussions, your place for the discussion of horror, film, fiction, and all that's fantastic. I'm one of your co-hosts, Philip, from the state of New Hampshire in the US of A, and with me in the state of Michigan.
This is Eric.
Eric, how are you, sir?
I'll just go with I am well.
Excellent, excellent. And that's your standard, usually, anyway. Right?
Yes, but I'm lying today. But move on.
Fair enough. And in the state of New York?
Motherfucking cunt burgers.
Excellent. Excellent. I'll have one of those.
That was Mike from New York. Yeah, he's having some laptop problems, so he's on his phone tonight. It is what it is. And we have a Connecticut American.
This is Chrissy.
Chrissy, how's it going?
Oh, living the dream. It's great.
Excellent, excellent. For folks who are new to the podcast or just found us or whatever, we are Dark Discussions Podcast, www.darkdiscussions.com, a genre podcast that discusses films such as horror, sci-fi, fantasy, thrillers, techno thrillers, mysteries, grindhouse, art house, and such. We basically try to talk intelligently about a genre that deserves intelligence. We do have numerous ways you can find us. You can just go to the website, darkdiscussions.com, or you can go to three different feeds. We have the Dark Discussions podcast feed, we have the Dark Discussions network of podcast feed, and actually those are the only two feeds, not three. So you can go to either of those two. We also have dozens of other podcasts, dozens meaning like about 25 other podcasts, both with your co-host tonight on different podcasts or other people who are just part of the Dark Discussions Network. Also, the Dark Discussions website has many articles that you can read and review, release notices, video and audio stuff. So go check that out. We do have a Facebook group, Dark Discussions Podcast Facebook group. We have a Twitter, Dark Discussion 1. And you can email us at darkdiscussions@aol.com or just go to the contact form on the website and type in your message there, and it goes directly to the email. Eric, what else can people find over there?
Well, there is a link to our Patreon account. Patreon is a service that allows you to financially contribute to your online artists like us. Producing this show is not something free of cost. For example, I just replaced my computer. And I know Phil's had to replace his. And there we have to pay for other stuff like server fees and renting movies and so on and so forth. So if you'd like to help us offset the cost of producing this show, that's how you can do it. You can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions or follow the link on the page. For every $5 a month that you care to donate, you'll have the opportunity to pick a topic for us to possibly do the show on. We take all the submissions from our patrons and draw one at random on a quarterly basis to do a show about. So if you care to help us out in that manner, we'd greatly appreciate it. You can go to patreon.com/darkdiscussions or go to the link on darkdiscussions.com.
That's right. And anything that you send is appreciated because we did have a huge bill over the summer of over $200 and something because we turned the website into a modern day event, and it now has the HTTPS, which that alone cost $100, never mind all the other stuff. So anything that you can give is appreciated, but we do not actually request it. We are only asking if
no, Phil, you're wrong. We're requesting it. It's okay to ask for money.
Fair enough. Fair enough. And we want to thank Christine Stroh, one of our latest listeners that joined the Facebook group maybe about 2.5 months ago, and she's very active on the Facebook group. She's a new Patreon, so we appreciate that, and thank you very much. All right, so I think we can get into our topic tonight. Eric, what are we going to discuss tonight?
Tonight, we're going to be discussing the 2020 movie directed by John Hyams, Alone.
Live nearby?
No, not really.
Where are you going?
I'm headed north. I'm sorry. I've got to go.
It's
I'm
just going to take
I've
a minute.
I've got to go. I'm late for a meeting. I'm sorry.
Hey, 911, what's your emergency?
I think I'm being followed.
I know you're close. Are you scared?
Please, just let me go.
Do you think you're the first one to say that?
Let me out of here!
I know fear when I see it. It's all in the eyes. People think they can hide it, but they can't. Not from me. Prove to me that I'm wrong. You hear me? I am coming for you.
Yes, that's right. John Hyams directed this film. It's a 2020 film based off of what he told us. He actually started filming it back in 2018. Later in this episode, you'll actually hear the director join us to discuss the film. The film stars just a couple of people, really, three people, to be honest. Jules Wilcox, and you'll learn how she got hired. Mark Menchaca, mostly well known for Ozark, and then Anthony Held, who is well known as a pretty good character actor. For folks who don't know who John Hyams is, he is the showrunner, creator, director, producer, all that good stuff of the Netflix fantastic television series Black Summer. He also is the son of a famous director as well, who actually did what did he do? Outland. His father actually did Outland, among other films. The Relic is another good one. But this film here was distributed by Magnet Releasing, which distributes a lot of pretty good small indie type films. And it is getting 93% ratings on Rotten Tomatoes, which is pretty fantastic for a thriller film. We also learned that it is playing at 44 drive-ins throughout the United States. And that's pretty much it. We will give you the wiki and explain what the film is in a bit. But before we do, we'll do a roundtable of how we heard about this film and what we thought about it. And since I was one that actually found out about it first, I'll go first. Me and my wife were doing the movie night, meaning, you know, watch a film on TV, VOD, whatever. And this film we came across because, unfortunately, iTunes doesn't do suspense / thriller anymore. They got rid of it. And now they throw everything into horror, drama, or action. And I have no idea why. And we couldn't find anything that night that we liked. So we went to indie section. And this film was brand new that day. And my wife liked the trailer. So we watched it. And we thought it was a pretty solid film. I actually liked it a whole lot. And immediately recommended it to Eric. My wife actually enjoyed it tremendously as well. It's not necessarily anything original, but it is very entertaining and very suspenseful. And I would give it a high recommend. So, yeah, absolutely. Let's go with Eric.
Well, I initially heard about this from Phil. He texted me about it, and I didn't act immediately. But after a little while, I was going back through my watch list and came across it and decided to give it a watch and enjoyed it. Tonight's episode is a little unusual because we interviewed the director. But usually the way this works is that we'll record a review of the movie and then interview people involved with the movie later. And this time it kind of got swapped around just because availability and timing. We actually interviewed the director before we're recording this right now. So it's going to be a little weird for us because we already spent like an hour and a half talking with the director about the movie. So just to put that out there so people are aware of that dynamic. But yeah, I really enjoyed this movie and I thought it was really well done, particularly due to the fact that there are really two main characters who spend about half the time not talking, and I still find it keeping my interest. So I enjoyed the movie, and I actually ended up recommending it to Watson, who watched it and enjoyed it.
Yep, very good. And let's go to review, Chrissy.
Well, I heard of it also from Phil when he said that we were going to do it. I looked at the trailer. I was very, interested in it because it just looked very different to me. But then when I kind of watched the movie, I realized it was one of those, movies where you have sort of, I feel the same way about home invasion movies. Home invasion movies don't really appeal to me, and usually the woman on the run from the scary killer dude does not normally appeal to me either. However, once I got into this movie, there were enough interesting things about it, particularly on a metaphorical level and on a deeper level, that I really did like it. And I think there's a couple of things in there that are just very well done on the suspense and the thriller. I have recommended this to a few people that do like this particular, I'm not going to call this a genre, but I'm going to call it maybe a subgenre or a category. It's like I said, it's like the woman on the run film usually doesn't appeal to me. But a lot of people I know that do enjoy that, I recommended it to them. They have watched it and said they loved it. So that's really good. And I think the director's discussion we had was amazing. And a lot of what I was going to say about this movie, I kind of already talked about with the director. So I will try to come up with different things so that you don't hear the same thing twice. But yeah, I mean, I actually ended up really liking this once I watched it the second time. And after our interview with the director, I went back and watched it a second time just so I could look for some other things that he had talked about and was able to make a few more connections. And that means the movie's really good. When you can watch a movie a second time and get more out of it than you did the first time, to me, that says well-made film. So anyway.
All right, very good. And let's go with you, Mike.
Okay, so I found out about it because Phil said we were doing it. I had not heard about it before, or if I had, easy to forget, because let's be honest, it is about as generic a horror title as you're going to find, something which the director will admit. And honestly, for the first, it takes about 35 minutes, 40 minutes. You know, it was I found it a kind of competently made, but unoriginal film. You know, a young woman alone, young woman comes across this creepy stranger kidnaps the woman, locks her up in her basement, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, it's nothing that we hadn't really seen before. It was well done, but it wasn't like grabbing my interest. I think it really plays off much better in the second half. So John Hyams is a guy who, I think, as Phil has already said, he was behind Black Summer. And so if you've seen Black Summer, it's kind of hard to tell to people what makes that different, because it's not on the surface any different than any other zombie story. It's all about kind of the execution. And so for me here, it's kind of how he executes it. It comes across very naturally, very in the moment. It's all done in real time, or mostly done in real time, which does help bring some suspense. So it's not a found footage film, but that's a part of a lot of found footage films where you're kind of trapped in the moment and as things happen. And so you get more of a voyeuristic feel to it, as opposed to it being overly edited and overly shot, you know, so things play out naturally. And it does pay off well, because really the two leads carry it, and they both give really, really good performances. And I just like the way things kind of play out in a very natural way. So I'm not going to say this is like a thing that reinvents the Woman in Jeopardy film, because I don't think it does. But I think it does it in the end. It does do it well, and it does do it in a way that ends up being engaging. So I would definitely give it a recommend.
All right, very good. So before we get into the wiki, for folks who care, since one of our listeners, like Pam, always requests, this is being recorded October 15th, 2020. And the interview section, which comes later in this episode, was recorded October 12th, 2020. So with that stated, Eric, what is the wiki?
Wiki. Sorry, I'm adjusting to a new computer. I forgot where the button was. A recently widowed traveler is kidnapped by a cold-blooded killer, only to escape into the wilderness, where she is forced to battle against the elements as her pursuer closes in on her.
Well, that says a lot about the story.
Yes.
I kind of think. So I don't know if it's a spoilery story, but it definitely.
Well, and let's be honest here. It's not like there's some huge twist in this movie, right? It's pretty straightforward, and like Mike was just alluding to, it's not a reinvention of anything. It's just a well executed version of something that's happened before. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I think it's happened before on this show where somebody's like, well, this is so unoriginal. I'm like, well, it doesn't matter, because it was so well done. And that's my opinion here, is that it may not be, you know, the most original thing you'll ever watch, but it's a really well-made movie, and I enjoyed it.
Indeed. I felt the exact same way. There was nothing original necessarily, but it was just a really good time when myself and my wife were watching it. All right, so we're going to get into spoilers.
And something I'll say, if I can, is that sometimes when films try to come up with a new twist, they end up, there's like only so much you can do. And like, do you remember for a while, like home invasion films were big?
Oh, yeah.
And then they all decided, hey, let's do a twist. And be like, they'll invade the home, but the people in the home are more fucked up than the invaders are. And the invaders,
yeah, we've got about 2 years of that.
And then yeah. and it's like they all came up with the same exact fucking twist at once. And we got 2 years of reverse home invasion films, because they were trying to avoid a cliche and just ended up creating a completely brand new cliche.
Yep.
So sometimes there's something to be said for just sticking to the basics.
Yeah, and that's a fair point. Now, some backstory about this. For example, with 1BR, it was just a kind of a joke that we decided. I contacted the director and the lead actress and whatnot to for an interview, you know, a little indie film that could. And we said, oh, yeah, I'll contact him, and we got him on. And then the honeymoon phase, same principal, Mike, in that case, say, hey, maybe we can get him on, because I actually met the lead actress and whatnot, and the film's damn good, so help promote. Well, this one here, same thing. I saw the film, and Eric's art, and he liked it a lot, so I decided to ask, you know, here's another little indie film that could. So it was just total coincidence. The day of the interview, that morning, was when I discovered that he was actually a big time director, because, you know, the screenrunner of Black Summer, you know, the screen the showrunner, I mean, and then that he had done Chicago PD and all these other television shows, and that he was really big, and he actually came from a Hollywood family. So total coincidence, but all the same, it is the little film that could. And he really is proud of the film and wanted to really focus on the film itself, Phil, rather than his career.
The moral of the story is it never hurts to ask.
Yeah, that's actually right. Yeah, because during the interview, as people will hear, we actually get some good tidbits about Black Summer in season two. So absolutely, it never hurts to ask. All they can do is say no or whatever, because I actually tried to get Lionel Shriver, the writer of We Need to Talk About Kevin, and the publicist actually said, yeah, I'll talk to her, and she actually did, and then she said no, but, you know, who knows? It could have happened, so.
Well, and the other thing, too, is I think we're in a very, you know, not to use the same phrase over and over again, unprecedented time right now, but we really are. And this is a really good time when filmmakers and writers and artists, they really need the attention more than ever now, because they just, you know, we need to get to people in their homes. You know, there's not a lot of money that's being put into giant ad campaigns and things like this, because honestly, everything's falling apart. So a lot of it, I think it is a little bit easier to access some of these people now than it would have been a year ago, too, because also there's not a whole lot going on, like, in terms of them out doing things. I mean, yes, we're all very busy, but how many movies and films are actually being shot right now? Not that many, I would imagine. You know what I'm saying? So, yeah. So there's a little bit, a little bit more play and schedule than there once was. That was just my point.
Yeah, I hear Brad Pitt's doing birthday parties now, so it's really sad.
Actually, Chrissy was the one that gave me, by saying that, she actually said this offline to all of us through instant message like a week ago, and that was what made me decide to actually contact another director of another movie that we did which was MOM, Mothers of Monsters, which folks will have this, that episode came out before this one, because that's the next episode to come out. So Chrissy was absolutely right. You know, you just took a shot. And we do have a pretty up-to-date fancy website, a big media play on the internet, and a decent amount of listeners at this point that they're more apt to consider us, because if they go to the website, they say, oh yeah, this actually has a lot of news and whatnot, a lot of podcasts, a lot of this and that. Well,
and the other thing too is that this is how we're helping our community. Think about it. We're in a very unique position to help these artists and writers and stuff now, because we do have a big listener base, and a lot of our listeners might not hear of some of these movies if we weren't talking about them. So I'm kind of looking at this interviewing the directors. The more we get, you know, we don't want to go nuts and change our format, but if we can get, you know, a few more, especially for films that are really excellent and maybe aren't getting the recognition, I think that's really helpful. This is how we can help out in the pandemic, you know, because we're, I mean, I don't know. That's just my thoughts on it, but whatever.
Indeed. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And I agree 100%. And you say everything you said sums up perfectly. We're not changing our format by any means, but every so often, at least during this time, when we find a little horror film that could, why not really, really promote it and whatnot? So, and bring in a director or an actress or whatever. But again, we're trying not to change the format, because I know some of our listeners, like Watson, which Eric just mentioned a little while ago, he's not into interview shows generally. And a lot of folks...
screw that guy!
Yeah, to hell with him. He's from the West Coast anyway. But on a serious note...
He's abandoned us on two podcasts now. Screw that guy!
Love you, hell. Watson. All right. Anyway, yes, Eric loves you so much he was going to come and visit you. Well, it's true, right, Eric?
Well, kind of. I was going to visit him while I was out there for a vacation. Yes.
Yeah, indeed.
I didn't plan my trip around visiting Watson.
Right, right. Now, let's see. So we'll talk about spoilers before we get into spoilers. Any other general items about the podcast or the director interview that we had? Anybody have anything they wanted to bring up? I mean, on the movie or the interview that we had that's coming up later. Anything that isn't spoilery? Anyone?
No, I would just say that it is it's worth a watch, and really it's filmed in the Pacific Northwest, and that's actually where I had planned my vacation that I didn't get to take because of the pandemic, and the nature out there is really pretty awesome, and some of it's in this movie. So,
well, Eric, and that's a good point that you brought that up, because the director explains, and I think you were the one that asked him the question, why he chose the Pacific Northwest. Yeah, Pacific Northwest, instead of, say, the desert or some other locale, because they were considering the desert and various other locales as well. And they finally decided to go with the Pacific Northwest, and he gives a reason. So it's a fairly good reason too. It makes sense. And as you said, it's very pretty, the scenery in this film. All right, so I guess we'll throw up the spoiler alert. So we'll talk about anything and everything, critique and review. If you haven't seen the film, it is now available on VOD rental only. You cannot get it for free, which is fine, because the film is good enough to
be, support your indie artists.
Exactly.
And I'm just going to step up on a soapbox for a second here, Phil, yes, which is that the horror community is constantly complaining about how they don't get enough horror movies. How they don't get enough good horror movies, mm-hmm, and yet when they come out, they don't actually go and spend their money on them, which is exactly how you don't encourage people to do it. Spend your money. That's how you can support the artists that do these things and get more of what you want. That's kind of how this capitalistic system works.
I don't think you understand, Eric. What they get much more satisfaction from paying to see Annabelle 7 and complaining about how terrible it is,
yes,
than they do from
Mike,
a movie that they might enjoy but they've never heard of before.
Well, and even that, Mike, even that, a lot of times, I remember, as we discussed in the past, you know, we talked about Edge of Tomorrow and how awesome that movie was, or some other, there was a couple other ones that were big that we saw at the theaters, not big, but were good enough that we went to the theaters and saw them, and we did an episode on it. And then like 5 months later, when it comes on VOD for free on Amazon or wherever, everybody starts talking about it. And it's like, dude, it was there 5 months ago and you could have helped those films, you know, and people just ignore them. And like Eric said, people complain, the film, oh, there's no films. It's like, but you don't go to the theaters. And then you got people like Tasia Lyman, the director of M.O.M., Mothers of Monsters, as well as Garo Nagosian, director of Dangerous People. And they're talking about how when they have it on Amazon Prime or Tubi or whatever, they only get a penny per hour watched, literally 1 cent per hour watched. So unless they get a big audience that knows about the film, meaning millions of people or hundreds of thousands of people, they barely get any money for all the work they did to put that film on the platform.
So I understand that times are tough and you might have the money to spend on entertainment right now. But if you don't spend the money on the entertainment, then shut up. You don't get to complain.
Indeed.
I'm done now.
Yeah, yeah. And to be honest, I know Watson promoted this film, and the director actually said he was going to mention that on Twitter or something, but that another podcast liked it as well. But the thing is that how many people are actually going to rent it, or are they just going to sit and wait until a year from now when it finally pops up on free, you know, on Amazon Prime?
Right.
You know, so anyway, we're going to talk about it, though, tonight. Well, it's still available for VOD purchase or rent. And also you can, like we said, 44 drive-ins throughout the country, wherever they are, actually have the film at the drive-in, which is kind of cool. All right. So where do we want to start? Eric, what do you think? You want to
Well, let's start at the beginning, which is that basically the beginning of this movie is this single woman, and we don't know about her situation yet, but we see she's moving. She's packing up a U-Haul trailer and goes on the road. And one of the things that I really appreciated about this movie is that, you know, we're used to seeing women in danger in horror movies. It's not a new thing, but I particularly thought it was well done in this movie, the sense of what it must be like to be a woman traveling by yourself in the world, and the fear that could accompany that. Because I have not had to deal with that in my personal life. I'm a big white dude. Apparently, people who don't know me find me intimidating, which I think is hilarious, because once you've heard me open my mouth, it's all over. So, I've never had to deal with being afraid while I'm just by myself, whereas for a woman alone in the world, it's probably a very different thing. And I thought that was very well expressed in this movie.
Yeah, and I do, speaking as a woman, Eric, I also just want to throw out the caveat, too, that, you know, it's at least for me, I've driven all over the place by myself, like hundreds of miles by myself, and I've never really felt that kind of a threat unless I was like on a dark road alone in the middle of the night and I was scared that my car was going to break down. That's mm-hmm. about the only time I felt it. And the only reason I'm making that comment is just because I feel like not every one of us feels that kind of terror all the time. I'm just saying, in your defense, you're being really awesome here and really kind, but not all of us feel that all the time.
I was trying to say that as someone who has generally not had to deal with that in my own life, I felt it through the character in the movie, and I thought that was intentional and well done.
Yeah, definitely. Oh, no, I definitely agreed, because I'll tell you, the way that some of those scenes were shot when she was driving on that road at night, it was like, oh, my God. Like, I know what that's like, and that is scary, and I think he did a really great job of that. Eric, just one point, were you talking about in the beginning where she's moving? I thought it was really interesting that the two things she left behind were the couch and the plant, because right. it kind of looked a little bit like a mini living room on the side of the road. And I think that kind of was nicely foreshadowed the fact that she was about to leave her comfort zone. So just to your point that, yes, it's a woman traveling alone. It's scary. It's whatever. She's leaving her comfort zone. And not only that, a couch and a plant, too, the way it kind of looked like a living room, suggests domesticity, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. What we know in our home, what we know within our four walls, the fact that women in general in history have always been looked at as the more domestic of the two genders, you know what I mean, or sexes, whatever the correct word is now that they call them, they call it. But they've always been the nest builders. So I thought that was sort of very interesting that the couch and the plant were there, because I was like, oh, she's leaving her comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
And we can always assume that when anybody's driving 4 days across the country or whatever. But that was just a really unique way of making that point without having a big lecture. Do you know what I mean? Or having a big, like, as you know, Bob thing.
Great, Christy. And I think that's an excellent point that you brought that up, because obviously it was kind of a humorous scene, but it was not there to be comic relief. It was there exactly what you said, at least in my opinion. In other words, I'm agreeing 100% with you that it was a symbol of her leaving her comfort zone, leaving things that make her feel good, make her, you know, she loved her plant, she loved her couch, but she can't fit it. And at ground point zero, where it's like, what do? I got to leave now. I can't fit it in my car. I'm screwed. And so she had to leave something behind that she didn't want to leave behind.
Well, and as we find out later in the movie, she didn't have to leave right then. In fact, the plan was for her to leave later. And she just felt like she wanted to leave right then, and that's what she had to sacrifice.
Right.
Yeah,
I was going to say, what I was thinking with the plant was just that it's like, of all the stuff she stuffed into her car, it's the one living thing she has, and she just abandons that. And I was wondering if that itself was sort of, again, foreshadowing, you know, that she's abandoning life. But I...
Wow, that's cool. Holy shit, that's so cool. Okay, sorry.
But, you know, that she didn't want to, but then, of course, you have the couch, and that doesn't really work well with the couch unless it has, like, bed bugs or something.
But
your point about the plant makes sense, though. Your point about the plant does make sense. It doesn't have to be both things. It can be one.
It's comfort and life. It's comfort with the couch and life with the plant, right? So it can be both. It can be both.
Right. Well, the difference is if you abandon a couch or a chair or a stereo or a TV, that's a thing. You leave it. You don't abandon it. You leave it. If it's a living thing, you abandon it. You know, so there's a difference to that. Admittedly, it's a plant. It's not a pet or a child. But it's still, it's a different feeling when you leave a thing that's alive, unless it was a plastic plant that you've been taking care of. You know, to me, that's a bigger abandonment thing than just a piece of furniture.
Right. Yeah, no, that's fair, Mike. That's fair. And so that's kind of how it is left. But it is, Eric made a good point too, which is that she technically didn't have to leave at that moment. Again, everything's packed and stuff, so maybe it would have been a pain in the ass to say, "Shit, I'll just wait until tomorrow and get a U-Haul and connect it." But it also could be at that point, and we find out later in the movie, she's not just leaving because she got a new job somewhere, or she's going to visit family and move back with, you know, where she grew up. She's also running away, and running away from memories that at one time were good, but they ended up bad because of what happens to her. And again, we're in spoilers to her spouse, and I believe it's her husband. And you know, when something tragic like that. And we can gather it's mental illness, and mental illness is most certainly an illness as bad as cancer or AIDS or COVID or any other type of major illness, because it can destroy a human being's health, never mind those around them who love them and watch them deteriorate and eventually pass on to the Rainbow Bridge, for example. So I think that's another reason why she just had to leave at that moment, and she couldn't wait until the next day and, you know, get the U-Haul.
Well, and there's a scene later in the movie. I don't think we want to do a point by point walkthrough of the plot, but there's a scene later when her captor, and actually at that point she's escaped and he's trying to track her down and take care of her. She's hiding in the woods, and he's trying to get her to come out, and he's trying to bait her to come out by talking about her husband that committed suicide, and he's baiting her and trying to enrage her so she'll come out from hiding and he'll be able to get her, and saying just some really horrible yet not untrue things about her husband and about how he probably tried to tell her. And she missed the signs, and he ended up committing suicide. I really enjoyed that scene personally.
Go ahead, Phil.
No, go ahead, Phil. And then I'll say what I was going to say. Okay. You go first.
Okay, sure. I like that scene a lot too, Eric. I figured she wouldn't come out because at that point we still had like 20, 25 minutes. So it wasn't going to be the ending. But it was suspenseful enough, which is she going to screw up? And then we're going to have another major chase scene where she has to escape. But instead, she's able to hang in there. And yet the expression, again, you know, this is we have the serial killer speaking And then she's just watching from like the bushes or not. And she doesn't even see him. She just hears him. And so everything that has to be emoted is through her expressions. And the actress just shows it like really, really good. And I can see why. Yeah, you picked up on that too, Eric. Now, Chris, are you going to say something?
I was going to say, I'm glad Eric kind of reminded me of that, because that was one of the things in this movie that I actually thought was something that I had never seen done before. We've seen our share, of course, of horror in horror films and other types of films, police procedurals and things like that, where the villain has a big speech that or a monologue that is trying to entice the hero or the heroine to screw up or make a mistake. I don't think I have ever seen one of these monologues, one of those types of monologues that was as well done and as visceral and as upsetting as this one. I was sitting there squirming, listening to the things he was saying, because they were beyond mean. They were cruel. Like,
they were evil.
Yeah, but it was the way it was delivered, too. It was also that actor did such a wonderful job, because it wasn't only what he was saying, it was how he was saying it. It was very matter of fact. It was not emotional, really. I mean, there was a couple points where he got emotional, but he never really came across. We know he's a psycho at this point, but he doesn't really come across as a psycho in that moment. He's more like, this is the facts. This is what happened.
But it's clearly delivered with intent to harm.
Yes. And it was just excellent. That was one of my favorite things in the movie that I didn't get a chance to ask the director about. I did want to ask him what the intent was with that. But anyway, go ahead.
Well, one of the things I've noticed in real life is that, because again, the story is the husband commits suicide. Is, you know, I imagine we've all known someone to some degree or another who has committed suicide. And different people react differently. And I've been kind of surprised. I always feel, you know, kind of bad that the person was in that state and you don't know it or we're unaware of it. Right. So I think I can put myself in her position there. But I've also known people that get very angry. And do get that sort of attitude of, if someone has committed suicide, they're cowards. And I've seen more than a few rants on Facebook. And I don't get into that, because it's clearly something that's very personal, that they got hurt by someone who did that. And I'm not going to validate or invalidate how they feel about that. But that, to me, was sort of what he was tapping into, is that anger some people have. When a person does commit suicide, the idea that they were a coward and they took the coward's way out.
Well, and that actually, now that you mentioned that, Mike, that might give us a clue to this character. Maybe there was somebody who did that to him.
Right, and we don't know, or he's just new to, you know, because if I were then in that position and I was trying to goad on somebody, I've seen enough people give that kind of a speech on Facebook that I could easily mimic it. So whatever it is, he's got something there. He clued in on it. We never get a motivation for the character, which I'm perfectly fine with, because it's all through her perspective. And, you know, we avoid that, as you know, Bob, moment where, as you know, when I was a child, my daddy touched me in a personal space. You don't get any of that stuff that you need to give this character's motivation. You don't need to know why the tiger is hungry. We just know that he's trying to eat you. And so I'm fine with that. But yeah, you do get a sense that maybe there's more there. And if you want, you go and kind of pick at this character's life and why he does the things that he does.
Right. Right. Now let's talk about this killer for a second. I think he was a perfect example of a serial killer, because he's normal when he's talking to his wife on the phone. And you find out he has a little girl at home and all this other stuff. And then to focus on his urges, he pretends he's on business trips. And then he does terrible, terrible, like really terrible things. And I think that that's the most dangerous type of person. You know, and I think this is where you come in, Eric, when you said, you know, women have to feel frightened when they're on the road. I mean, women have to feel frightened no matter what. When they, I mean, they could go to a bar in downtown Seattle, in this case, because, you know, this is the Pacific Northwest, and you know, you don't know who these people are that you're talking to, or, you know, it's just really scary. And this guy, the actor, I forget how to, his name, Markchenko, I think. He really shows the split personality of what a serial killer does. And the actor's a great actor anyway, because, I mean, we've seen him in Ozark. And in Ozark, he plays a good country folk, you know, a bumpkin type guy. And here, he plays a businessman that's lovely to his family, and then psychopathic and horrific to the young lady that he's stalking.
Phil, didn't that good country bumpkin folk in Ozark, unless I'm getting it wrong, try to have somebody murdered and, yes, and engaged in theft? I think you might want to revise.
Let me rephrase. I had good in quotes, like good country folk. It was a. He's a redneck. Right, Mike? I said it. Bastard.
Yeah, that was awesome.
All right, but he plays a really good redneck, and in this here he shows that he has a wide range as an actor to play so many different types of characters.
It taps into that thing that you always hear about serial killers. You know, oh, he was always so quiet. He was just, you know, he was a great neighbor. He never bothered anybody, and all so on and so forth that we all know. It's kind of playing into that stereotype. And the thing is, you're saying that the women have to be afraid. I don't think all women have to be afraid at all times, because that's no way to live. But let's put it this way. Aware is a better word, yeah. There have been moments in my life where I've, like, made a friendly comment to a woman that I don't know, and she's like kind of giving me side eye, and my initial instinct is to be offended. Like, I was just trying to be nice. But then I watch something like this, and I'm like, oh, she might think she doesn't know me. She might think I'm a person like that. So no wonder she was wary. And it's something that's good to keep in mind as you go through life and interact with women, because especially ones that don't know you, because they don't know you. So just keep it in mind.
yeah, absolutely. And the director actually even explains it, right? I mean, his story about how he walks his dog at night, and there's this woman that always crosses the street to be on the opposite side of him because she doesn't know who he is. And, you know, and he could tell that it wasn't because it was convenient to walk across the street. It's just because she's probably saying exactly what you're saying, Eric. And that most certainly is something that
Character in this movie, yes, he ends up to be a completely psychotic serial killer. However, when you first run into him, when he first interacts with the character, he doesn't necessarily say or do anything wrong. In fact, he apologizes for his moment of road rage the day before. So, even if somebody is acting appropriately, it doesn't necessarily mean they're okay. And I thought that was also another thing that was done well.
Yeah. Yeah.
I did want to just say something here that Eric mentioned, which, and that is too, when you're saying, you know, watching the comments with women because they don't know you, you know, you can also sort of tell when a guy is just off. This guy is off. Like, I do not blame this girl by being freaked out, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been talked to by plenty of strange guys and plenty of bars, and in my, you know, long history of drinking or going out and doing social things, and I can almost pretty much tell you that most of the people that I met that were strange guys were pretty decent, and I could tell that. Mm-hmm. Then there were maybe three or four where I was like, oh my God. Like, it's almost like you have a radar of some sort, where you're like, okay, something is wrong with this dude. And well, so not everybody, I mean, sometimes they can hide it, sometimes they're not aware, but this guy clearly presented himself in this film as being Creepsville.
Well, and like, it's also an escalation, right, in this movie, because we have the moment on road, and then they run, and then they run into each other later, and okay, you can chalk that up to coincidence, I suppose. And then they run into each other again. Now we're getting out of coincidence territory and into a little bit of creepy territory. And then he runs into him blocking the road, and that is like, oh, shit. This was done intentionally. There's no way it wasn't done intentionally, even though he's acting like it's not. And he acts all offended that she doesn't want to give him a ride to the gas station when her reaction is completely justified.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and even if she hadn't met him earlier and he hadn't been someone that was a little off, as Chrissy said, even if he was polite, I don't think any woman, never mind, actually any man for that matter, should necessarily just let a stranger in their car and drive him to.
Picking up strangers on the road is generally a bad idea.
Yeah, exactly. And I remember we watched that Eyes of Our Mother movie, and I hated that movie. And I said it was terrible what they did to the hitchhiker. And Eric made a good point. He goes, Phil, it's her own fault because she picked up the hitchhiker. And I go,
exactly.
Yeah.
You shouldn't pick up a hitchhiker unless you want horrible things to happen to you.
Right, right. Or if you break down, you don't want to get in the car either, as we saw in The House That Jack Built with Uma Thurman's character. You know, so
well,
I will tell you, as a side thing,
you know, talking about how when you know somebody's off or not, back in Rhode Island, January of 1993, I broke down on a probably 0-degree night in the middle of January on Route 112, which is kind of like I was in the middle of nowhere. And the car died. It turned out that the timing chain had just gone. So the whole car just died. Everything died. So I'm freezing cold. And all I see is this creepy farmhouse, like, you know, a distance away. And I was like, okay, I need to go there and ask whoever's there to use the phone. So I go to the creepy farmhouse. I'm freaking scared to death. It's totally dark. There's no lights. I go up, I knock on the door, and this guy comes to the door with no shirt, and he's covered in like red paint. And it was clearly paint. Like, he was painting. He had a paintbrush in his hand. And I just remember standing there going, oh, fuck.
That's awesome.
Something is off with this guy. So I said, can I use your phone? And he's just standing there looking at me. And I'm like, can I just use your phone? My truck broke down. Actually, I had a truck at the time. And he goes, sure. Do you want to come in for a minute? And it was the way he said it. And he said, so who are you going to call? And I was like, oh, my God. I said, well, actually, I'm going to call all the brothers at this fraternity house that I was on my way back from a party, and I'm sure they're all going to come get me. And then the guy kind of backed off. You know what I mean? So it was like that moment of fear where I was like, oh, dude, if I didn't tell him a bunch of big football-playing guys were coming to get me, I don't know what would have happened.
You know what, Chrissy? I bet you back in those days, if you called – two towns over, it was considered long distance, so he was probably just worried they were gonna give him a $20 phone bill.
Probably, yeah. I mean, I did. I called Teak. All my football playing buddies were there, and I said, hi, I'm at this address and I'm at this guy's house. And it must have been the way I said guy's house, because I swear to God, they were there in like 10 minutes. Like, they must have been going like 90 miles an hour. But anyway, I could tell something was off with that guy. And I was kind of wishing, oh, shit, I wish I'd gone to another house. But anyway, that's an example of when I had terrifying fear in the middle of nowhere from some freaky guy.
Well, here's a quick story. When I was like 22, I my first job, me and this girl, that was like 33 at the time, I was 22. We were working wicked late to get this program done for the software that we're working on. And I still had to work for another hour after that. And she comes into my cube and says, hey, Phil, could you walk me to the car? And, you know, we're on the sixth floor. And I'm like, yeah, sure. Why? What's the big deal? And she goes, well, it's nighttime and I don't want to walk to my car alone at this hour because you never know. And I was like, and I literally had like a light bulb that my whole life changed at that moment. It was like, oh my God, yeah. And a woman, 8 o'clock at night on an October or November night, walking across a parking lot, she just doesn't know, you know? And so it is a thing that people have to think about. And
oh, it is. Like I always would, whenever I had to walk around campus in the dark or whatever, especially by myself, I would always carry, you know, the keys in between the knuckles, you know?
Yeah, right, right.
You know, and well, it's not going to buy you much, but it'll buy you something, you know?
There are no absolutes. I'm not going to say that no man ever gets sexually assaulted.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
But in general, men don't have to walk around worrying about it, and women do, and that's unfortunate.
Yeah.
Indeed. Yeah, and this film here, she was playing it like she wants to be polite, but she doesn't want to help him. And she's trying to play it both ways. And everybody's been in that situation where you're trying to be polite and you're waiting for them to say, oh, all right, no problem. But they refuse. And it's like, you know what? You just have to just slam it down and move on.
Well,
like,
and I think that, you know, that moment says, I'll be happy to GPS or call you a tow truck.
Yeah.
Like, exactly. It's not like she's like, fuck you. Like, right. And she's offering perfectly reasonable solutions. These are right. not like dumb ideas. They make total sense.
And any adult male would understand why the woman isn't allowing them in the car, unless they were really clueless assholes or they had other reasons, which this guy had most certainly other reasons. Mike, you were going to say something? I heard you were about to say something.
No, I wasn't. I'm just testing. I got my microphone problem fixed, so I was just kind of testing noise.
Gotcha. Not a problem. So that was a very uncomfortable moment when he was asking for the ride to the gas station because she's being as polite as she can. I could see exactly why and what she was thinking.
Well, and he just won't take no for an answer.
Exactly.
Well, exactly. I mean, and here's the thing. This is where human nature or the kindness of human nature can bite you in the ass, right? It's very easy to say, well, the guy's in a bad situation and maybe he doesn't see, you know, if he's a harmless guy, maybe he wouldn't see how she would see it. You know, some guys are not as self-aware as Eric is, you know, to realize how disturbingly creepy he is when you encounter him on a dark road in the middle of the night.
I don't like the way you said that.
Okay. Truth hurts. Sorry. No, but I mean, it just, no, but look, I mean, I've certainly been in, you know, in that same position, right? Where if you approach a woman without reason, you know, they may get at first a little nervous. And I'm a big guy. I was like actually one of the smallest kids in my graduating class until like my senior year. So there's a part of my brain that still has never quite accepted that I've got to above average height and then above average girth. And it doesn't quite register in my head sometimes that I am a big guy and I can come across as intimidating until, like Eric, I open my mouth. But yeah, I mean, I would never, but even if it's stopping to help somebody, you know, they don't know really why you're stopping. But you could also see just easily how that would work on somebody. Hey, I'm desperate. I'm in bad mood. I'm in a bad position. And he does come across as kind of a decent guy. And if it had been the first time she had met him, she might have picked him up. But there's that whole history before she gets there, right?
Right.
You know, where she deals with the thing on the road, and then he runs into her at the truck stop. And by that point, yeah, you're totally getting stalker vibes.
Oh, yeah.
Well, the thing was, though, I think she went around him, right, on the road, and then she's at the gas station. And that's where she first gets that bad vibe because she sees his truck right in town near that gas station. And then he approaches her in the hotel parking lot. And then it becomes the truck stop. So it really, the escalation of this is really in this. I believe Eric or one of you mentioned it is really well done. How it like slowly escalates, you know?
Yeah, I think it was me that mentioned that.
Yeah, I think it was. And it is interesting. I know, Mike, you said, you know, you weren't a big fan of necessarily the beginning part. But and obviously you pretty much kind of gathered, you knew where it was going to go, because it was going to be a cat and mouse, you know, kind of like Trucks, you know, the Steven Spielberg film or something, or the one with Kurt Russell.
Duel, yeah,
that's what I meant. Not Trucks, I'm sorry. Duel, which is the Steven Spielberg film, and then there was the one with Kurt Russell, that was pretty good too. From a couple of years ago, J.T. Walsh was the villain in that one, and his wife—he has to leave his wife in the desert.
Did the movie have a title?
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I was hoping one of you guys would know immediately what film it was.
was it called The Swedes?
No.
Okay, it was a guess.
Honestly, J.T. Walsh. He passed away, so I'm assuming I could find it easier looking through his stuff. Even a Sling Blade.
Hey, so
Breakdown.
Kirk
Breakdown.
Or Michael
Breakdown.
Douglas?
Breakdown. Kurt Russell.
Kurt Russell. Oh, okay. I thought you said Kurt Douglas. Okay.
Yeah, no worries. Yeah, Breakdown. That was a pretty good one too. And so you kind of knew that this one was going to go that way too. So even though it slowly was building it up, and you kind of already knew that our stranger, simply called the man, he didn't have a name, played by Mark Menchaca, you kind of figured that he was probably going to be one of those guys. And as Chrissy said, she could feel the offness. And I actually kind of felt offness too, because even though he apologized about the road rage, just to do that road rage was enough to make me say, this guy is a scumbag, and I don't care if you apologize.
Right.
You know.
But well, again, if you're a woman alone and this guy's knocking on your window, you're not going to say, F off, dick, because
right.
He's going to smash your window in and punch you in the face. Oh, wait, he did that later. Yeah.
Yeah, okay, so he does try to justify the road rage as not being road rage, that when she passed him, he realized he would run on the phone, he was running late, and so he suddenly sped up, right? And that was the reason for the thing. It wasn't actually road rage. It is the lamest excuse I think I've ever heard for someone's behavior. It was a terrible lie, not as in it was a bad lie, but it was a lie badly told. But at least he was trying not to pass it off as road rage.
Well, but here's the thing. It so obviously was just from what he did. Nobody who's texting on a phone does that while they're driving, does that kind of aggression. You can't do both, dude. I don't care if you're Aristotle. You cannot do both. Like, you're either pissed off and really focusing on this cat and mouse thing, or you're texting. People that text wander. They don't, like, speed up and try to get aggressive.
Well, and it's
clearly
also,
he's full of shit. But anyway.
And also, it's just I've observed this from, I mean, up until this year, the last several years, I've driven to Connecticut and back for our Mystic meetup. And people just inherently, it doesn't matter how fast they're going, they inherently don't like being passed. It's a weird thing, because you'll start to pass somebody because they're going slower than you want to go, and then as you're past them, they'll speed up, so they're right next to you, and you can't get past them. It's like, dude, just let me get in front of you, and everything will be okay.
So, right, this isn't a personal affront, you know? It's I'm just going somewhere, and that's it. I'm out of your life tomorrow. Yeah, I mean, you know, within the 2 minutes.
So, like, at first in that scene, it's just like, well, you know, he doesn't want to pass him, whatever. But the fact that she's hauling a trailer and the fact that there's an oncoming truck really makes what he does really out of line.
Yeah, it reminded me when I used to work for Harriman State Park and doing nature education. And one of the camps contacts me. They had their dog attacked a fawn. And so I had to go get my boss. And it was like at 3:30 and they closed up the museum at 4:00 and I've got to drive halfway across the park to get him. And I got stuck behind a person and I'm trying to pass him and he wouldn't let me pass. Cause he was like, no, I'm enjoying a leisurely stroll and watching the scenery. You need to do it too. And it's like, I've got a deer bleeding out in the camp in front of a bunch of nervous kids. Can you please let me go? You know, some people are just idiots like that.
Yeah, Yeah.
Well, see, and this is where you boys need to learn how to drive like you do in Connecticut. So when you pass an asshole like that and they won't let you pass you, you keep going until you finally get past them. Then you cut in front of them and you slam on the brakes so that if they hit your ass end, it's their fault. And their insurance is going to pay for it with their nice BMWs and Audis. We used to play that all the time. It's called Connecticut Chicken, just so you know.
That wasn't going to help this
guarantee
year.
You, and,
yeah,
guarantee
well,
you they will never do that shit again. They will never do that shit again.
I live in Michigan where we have no fault insurance, so that's a problem.
Oh, yeah, Michigan. What are you going to do? Michigan. Well, what are you going to do? Anyway.
That's like the time I said to Eric, Michigan looks so nice, and you're like, no, don't come here.
Well, I had some of my French Quebec family came from Michigan originally, and maybe that's the reason why they left. I don't know. So.
There are a bunch of people here. I'll cop to that.
Now, let's see. Let's move on to post-abduction. So eventually her car is sabotaged, the tires or something, and it crashes and whatever. And then he pretends to help, and she doesn't want his help. And then that's when he breaks in the car, smashing the window and all that other stuff that you said, Eric. And we have the abduction and the basement scene, which in a, I guess, a 1970s grindhouse film would have been much worse than what we saw. Because fortunately, he moves on to come back later, and
quite frankly, I was glad for it because I just really don't enjoy watching
sexual assault.
People get tortured on film or sexually assaulted. Like, all that makes me feel really pity icky. So I was glad they moved on for it. I was also glad that when he asked her to undress, they don't go there, and he ends up doing something almost creepier by just kind of cuddling with her and making her tell him about her husband. I thought that was actually way more effective and a way to keep me engaged than making me uncomfortable and avert my eyes by getting sexual assault involved, because I just don't enjoy that personally.
Yeah. I mean, she's easy on the eyes. But if she had actually had to address it, it obviously wouldn't have been a quote unquote sexy scene. So it was most certainly going to be a disturbing scene no matter what. And fortunately, it was only a psychologically disturbing, and it didn't go into the violence or assault that it could have. But the threat was there, which I guess made it more psychologically horrifying. Because it was there, even though it didn't happen, and that most likely it was going to happen, never mind her knowing that she's probably not going to survive. No.
And it's also weird, like I have weird reactions to stuff in movies, because like, I've watched however many slashers where people get stabbed and chopped and whatever, and it really doesn't affect me much on an emotional level anymore. But when he punched her in the car, I was like, oh, Jesus! Because for some reason, that has more of an impact on me. The punching than a slasher movie. I don't know what it is, but I found that to be especially brutal when he just like didn't hesitate at all, didn't hold back at all, just fucking socked her right in the jaw.
Well, and you know what I think? I just think in general, Eric, punching in films like that is a lot more brutal simply because we can relate to that. Okay, we don't walk down the street every day or go to a bar and there's a bar fight and people pull out knives or guns. Okay, in some cases, yes, they do. But most of the time when you see a fight, what happens? It's just a fist fight. It's somebody punching people. So we see that all the time. That's a little bit more, it takes it into the real realm, the realm that, oh my God, this could actually happen, rather than here's this dude with a knife, like stabbing this girl in a car. Yes, but that's mostly a movie thing. Like, we hear about that. Yes, there are real life cases where that does happen, but it's mostly things we see in the news. You know, it's not something where somebody gets a little pissed off in the supermarket and just, you know, like pulls out a knife and stabs somebody. That's not an everyday right. thing. Right. But somebody getting in a fist fight in a grocery store over the last box of macaroni, that does happen. Mm-hmm. Like, you can see that any day of the week. You can probably go into any place, and if somebody's on fire about something, what weapon do they have available? Their fists. And I've right. always thought that that's why punching in these movies is so much more effective, just because we actually, most of us have seen that in mm-hmm. real life. Mm-hmm. Even if we've only seen it once, we've actually seen it for real at least once. Even if we were just kids on the playground or something, we've seen it.
Yeah, and but that's that,
why, I think.
But that would go no matter who it is on the screen. Whether it's Goldie Hawn or Kurt Russell, you know, you would have the similar reaction. People do just, it's sort of like, you know, the difference between killing a person and killing a dog is there is a different reaction when a woman gets punched in a film. I've seen movies where people protested and complained that had brutality against women because a woman got punched or hurt in some way and meanwhile in the film, dozens of males have been brutally murdered and gruesomely injured, but nobody gave a shit about that. There is still a different attitude among people towards women that is, I think, somewhat more protective. I think it's, you know, the fact that we like to pay money. People love watching Keith David and Roddy Piper battle it out in an alleyway
out of each other,
for
right.
22 minutes and they live. You know, people pay money to watch, you know, MMA fights. You know, Muhammad Ali was, you know, glorified for his ability to knock people into unconsciousness. We accept violence from males to males much, much more easily than we do violence aimed at women or violence aimed at children. And I'm not saying that we should accept that violence, you know, but it's just that same emotional thing. And it's not a thing I think we can easily quantify. Just like, why is it, you know, that in the Red Wedding episode of Game of Thrones, you see dozens of people killed and then they kill the dog. And that's when everyone gets upset.
Right, right. Well, and there's also the fact that the punch wasn't done in a Hollywood style. And what I mean by that is often when you watch this male-on-male violence that you're referring to, Mike, if, you know, Sly Stallone gets into a fight in a movie, it's enhanced with all these sound effects that are not realistic. You know, when he punches somebody, it sounds almost like an explosion or something. There's this loud whack, whereas the punch in this movie is done very realistically, and it's a very like meaty sound of the fist connecting with flesh, which is really a lot more what it sounds like in real life. And maybe that's also part of what I was reacting to, is the realistic nature of how they portrayed it.
Now, Mike, what was that film that you just mentioned with the dog gets killed?
All of them.
Yeah, I'll try to avoid all.
All the dogs are killed in every movie.
It's a terrible thing.
I was talking about Game of Thrones, Phil.
Yeah, but about wolves. I mean, it was bad, but it wasn't the same.
No, it was the same thing. It's just people have hearts.
Yeah, I guess you're right. Yeah. All right, I'm convinced. Then we have the scene where she does escape, and that whole scene where we see him eating calmly, lying to his wife, talking to his daughter, and, you know, being as normal as you can get, I think would may have been the most disturbing scene of the entire film, at least for me.
Well, the first time I watched the movie, I was a little bit distracted during that scene, so I wasn't like, I got the fact that he was on the phone and she was hiding. I didn't really catch the conversation he was having. And the second time I watched the movie before we talked to the director, I actually had the subtitles on and saw everything he was saying on the phone. I was like, okay. He's a family man. That makes this creepier.
Yeah. I thought that was really disturbing myself. I was like absolutely horrified.
Well, and I also really, that was one thing in the movie I also really loved, is that the wife became her out. Like, you know what I mean? Like, she called the wife.
That was beautiful.
I just thought that was beautiful and ballsy and just so different. you know, even though we had talked about this being sort of that woman in Jeopardy, that cat and mouse, that's the phrase I was looking for earlier. Not necessarily the woman running away from a killer, but I was really looking for cat and mouse subgenre. That's kind of what I was looking for. That really made this just so awesome. I was like, you go.
Well,
like, and it almost plays into like the one, like the woman calling the wife of the guy she's sleeping with and going, hey, you know, do you know what your husband's doing? Like, there's kind of a certain bond between women like that. And I loved how they played with that. That was just really great.
And also in that scene, up until that point in the movie, Mark Menchaca's character really hadn't been, I mean, he had been a little concerned about the fact that she was escaping. But he really, I don't think, had been scared. He'd been angry. He'd been annoyed. But when he realizes that she called his wife, he looks scared. You see that look of realization on his face that at that moment, no matter what happens, whether he gets her or not, his life is over. His life just got ruined. And I thought that was a great moment.
Yeah, absolutely. It was an awesome moment. It actually, made him actually more dangerous at that. Well, I mean, how can he be more dangerous than he was? But it made him where he was just going to go out. In other words, even if he was going to die, he was going to make sure that he took her with him. And so the thing is that she decides to stand her ground because, you know, she's already wounded. She isn't going to be able to run far. So she's doing the same thing as him, which is, if I'm going out, I'm taking you out with me. So,
well, and up until that point, he'd just been like, I don't know how serial killers think of it, pursuing a hobby. But at that point, it became personal and he wanted to kill her because she had hurt him. Whereas before that, he was just acting on whatever impulse killers have, which I don't understand. But I thought his motivation at that moment stepped up a notch and became personal.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, exactly. And to be honest, at that point, I think it became personal to her, too, because he had already abused her mentally about her husband. And then he, you know, the whole cat and mouse on the road, and then the whole basement scene. And at that point, when she was wounded and she knew that she couldn't run away from anymore, that's when she became the... I guess, a savage herself. And she was going to do, she was using vengeance at that point as well. So I think she was doing vengeance too. So that was what was kind of interesting about the end, is that they were almost, even though one was a psychopath, the other one had become as desperate. And so they were both to their total extremes, and they were both head to head. And it was really who was going to come out on top. And luckily for her, he had two things against him, which was he was wounded as well from the car crash, the first thing. And the second thing is he wasn't thinking straight anymore. You know, to be able to get away with all those murders in the past, he had to be a pretty smart guy. But at this point, he was enraged, and it didn't matter to him. And that made him weaker as a fighter because he wasn't going to be – he was going to be more careless, I guess.
Right.
Well, one of the things I thought was interesting with that – with that ending and that phone call is he does that rant about being a coward, and then he's terrified of his wife, right? He shits himself over, or his wife found out about what's really going on, you know? So in a weird way, you know, it kind of turns that on him and reveals his own cowardice. It's not a thing that that's a thing that they could have taunted him with in another film, and maybe one that was trying to make a point, as opposed to just letting it sit there. But I did kind of like the way that played out.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah, because it is funny is that even though he's a family man, whatever, you could tell back at his house, he was, you know, the wife was the one that ran the house. And again, it didn't mean that he was nitpicked or he was taking out rage on other women because he hated his wife or whatever, because we never really learn enough to know what his motivations are, or we don't know enough about his family life. But you did make a good point there, Mike, and it makes me now wonder, because of the type of crimes that he does, and we know that he's most likely have done this many times before, based off of the conversation with his wife that, oh, yeah, I'm on business again, and I'll be home like the last time or whatever, that he chooses woman, and the way he treats this woman, it's misogynistic as hell. So I think he may hate woman. In other words, he's not just killing because he likes killing. I think he hates the other gender for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. And that makes him obviously more scary, especially for our lead character, because we're in her perspective, the female's perspective. But also it makes an interesting question, and it would be kind of interesting to see his home life and to see if his wife is just a fine person, based off of the few conversations we had that we saw her, or I should say heard her on the phone. She seemed normal. But either way, it's no excuse for his actions by any means, even if she was.
Or maybe she controls him, and actually what he was going to do is bring her back to his wife, and now she ruined the surprise.
Oh, that is so deliciously sick. I love that. I love that idea. That was like kind of like my idea where I told you guys when I was watching it, I was sort of like, you know, it would be really screwed up if this movie went to a place where she wasn't, where this guy is not the stalker, where this guy actually, like, cause what you remember when she was at the truck stop and there were all these other truckers just kind of coming and going and smoking and all that. I was like, dude, I wonder, wouldn't it be cool if this movie, where it turned out where some other guy she's never seen turns out to be the aggressor, and then this creepy dude is the one who ends up saving her? Like, I don't know. It's just this movie leaves you room as the viewer to, as you're watching it, sort of imagine these different kind of crazy scenarios, which is interesting. Because most of these movies are very especially in the cat and mouse genre, they're pretty, you know, they're pretty straightforward. But I think with this film, there's enough depth. There's enough depth of theme, too. You know, one of the themes that we talked about the other night with the director was the theme of being alone, how you are alone in your own skin. And I thought the way that that was reinforced was really well done, because all the other characters, except for that one hunter that we see, they are only communicated with on the phone. Their voice is on the phone, so that only. So that also reinforces that theme of we are in our own selves and nobody else really knows who we really are. And by having those other characters like the wife and the daughter, they are the voices of his other life. And just like the girl who's running, her parents are the voices of her other life, the life she's leaving behind. And so those voices being distant puts an emotional kind of barrier up, and also reinforces the idea that we are alone in our own selves and we never really know who we're around, you know? So, but yeah, that's one of the things I loved about this movie, is that it did kind of leave you avenues to sort of think, ooh, you know, what if it went this way? What if it went that way?
All right. Any other scenes that we wanted to bring up or discuss?
Christy just mentioned the hunter, and that's really the only thing we haven't talked about, which is when she's running through the woods trying to get away from her captor, she runs into this random hunter dude. And he kind of takes her in and gives her a ride, and they're in his car, and he's giving her boots and food and water. And I think it was Christy that was mentioning that she was getting ready for him to like be in league with the other guy. But was it you?
Okay. Well, I mentioned it with the conversation with the director.
Okay. But he turns out to just be like a good guy who's out in the woods hunting and wants to help this girl. But then they run into the antagonist, who just totally gaslights this dude to the point where he doesn't know what to think. And then he catches him off guard and kills him, which is a bummer because he was trying to help and he ends up dead. So yeah, I thought that whole scene where the killer was gaslighting the hunter was really very effective, and you're just sitting there almost yelling at the screen, "Don't listen to him! He's full of shit! Don't listen to him!" I thought it was pretty well done.
Oh, and the gaslighting was really a good story. He goes, "Yeah, that's my wife and our daughter," or something he said.
I think it was sister.
Yeah, sister, that's it. And you know, she has...
She's off her meds. She's having one of her episodes.
She's a behavioral health individual and whatnot. And so now the guy's not sure.
Behavioral health individual.
He did not use those words, just to be clear.
Every time you say that, it just makes me laugh.
That's because Phil's the only... Phil is a behavior health individual because he's the only person that uses that term.
I love it. It's politically correct.
What I thought was funny, Phil,
it's not, Phil. You made it up.
But I think it's cool. But anyway, sorry. Go on, Phil. I didn't mean to interrupt you. You were talking about how she's off her meds, blah, blah, blah. You know.
Yeah, yeah. And so... And then the hunter's like really wondering now who's telling the truth, but he's smart because he says, you know what? Maybe you're right. Maybe she's right. Let's just have the police come and they'll settle the whole thing.
Yep.
And that's the right thing to do. However, the hunter let his guard down, unfortunately. And yeah, he didn't make it. Mike, you were going to say something.
I was going to say, I thought it was funny, Phil, because that's actually the second time we've seen that plot device recently, because we just saw it in, I think it was episode 5 of Lovecraft Country, the Ruby episode, when she's wandering the streets in a daze, and they say, oh, it's the sister or the wife, and she's off her medication. So we had just seen that, yeah. But hey, you know what? It is a very, for those of you who are in this situation and don't know how to handle it, that's what you got to do. You just got to say it's your sister and she's off her meds, or your wife, depending on, or your daughter, something like that, depending on the age difference.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
This is why we're here, to help you kidnappers, help deceive the public.
Well, I am so glad about that, because the next time I decide to go psycho, I am totally going to like use that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm telling you,
caught last time.
Yeah, these fucking good Samaritans make it. I mean, we're just trying to do a little something to improve the world, and no, somebody's got to come along and be all, "Ooh, let me help."
Bastards.
There is one thing I did want to comment on too, Mike. You had said earlier that you know, this story very much sticks to the basics of the whole cat and mouse thing, except for some few fun little things in it, which, I mean, I really thought were nice surprises and well done. But I did want to point out that it's okay that this movie sticks to the basics and that it's not completely original, as we had said, because that's not really the story that I think they're trying to tell here. I don't think they're really trying to tell a standard cat and mouse type of story. I think this is really more of an internal story about the emotional journey of this woman. And I did not want to talk about any of that during our review here, because I know that we talk about that at length and the director has a lot to say about that. So I didn't want to spoil any of that.
Right. And I highly recommend that you listen to that part. I think the director was great. He actually touched on a few dark discussions, running jokes, which I thought was hysterical, completely unaware. I think he's
weeds.
Yeah, I think he's a dark discussion spirit animal.
Oh, and the Ozark. Drink, everyone drink.
Yeah, he mentioned Ozark. He mentioned they're all Swedes. And so I thought that was kind of cool. But so the other spot I was waiting, because again, novelty only works once and then stops being novel. And then the more you watch it, the twists kind of go away. Everything has to stand on its own anyway. If you rewatch a film, it has to have more to it than just the novelty. And novelty can be great as a hook, but give me competence over novelty any day. I think I said that actually in the review of the last episode, or the late second to last episode of Lovecraft Country, is that I'd rather it be cliched and competent than novel and poorly done. So the other place I was waiting was to find out, like, the wife was somehow in on it. You know, that right, when he was right. talking to her on the phone, he had to talk in code in case somebody was listening. Like, maybe he was in part of, like, a sex trafficking ring, and that's how he was actually making his money.
Right, right.
You know, so some part of me was wondering, like, when he was talking about he's there on business, is, you know, did she know what his business was? You know, because, again, that would be the last place for them to pull a twist. And they didn't. And I'm fine with that. I am not disappointed when there isn't a twist, if what you're doing works. I know there was one movie, and I can't remember what which one it was, where I just said, you know, it was just perfectly predictable. We knew all from beginning to end everything that was going to happen. Here, I didn't actually know, like, I didn't expect her to pull out the phone, and I certainly didn't, you know, and make that call, right? Which, it makes sense, but I didn't expect her to do that. And I thought it was smart and clever. And that was the quote-unquote twist to it. It was a novel way out of her predicament. The fight in the car was handled in a very realistic way, I thought. You know, and that was sort of the novel way of doing it. He didn't try to come up with some grand, oh, they were dead all along sort of twist. They just told a good story.
Yep, and that's true, Mike. Yep. They went somewhere different without creating a new subgenre that would become cliche, and yet it fit perfectly into the story without, I was going to say ruin or cliche, but I guess in other words, it was not obvious. It came out of nowhere, and it was like, oh, that was a brilliant thing, calling the wife because she got his cell phone.
Well, all right. I personally get a little frustrated when people complain about movies being unoriginal, because there's that theory out there. I'm sure you've heard it, that there are really only 7 stories and everything else is just a variation on one of those. So sure, it's like, come on, like, nothing's really original.
No, nothing isn't. I mean, nothing is. Everything is, like you said, one of 7 stories, or it's all been done before. I think what we really need to be looking for in a film is it well done? You know, is it well executed? And is the story that it's telling solid and of interest? And does it hold your interest? And does it have something to say? You know, not every film has something to say, but most of them do. You know, and the good thing about art is that art of any kind, whether it's painting or film or short story or whatever you're doing, if it touches the viewer or the reader, then it's done its job. And so whether or not it's, like, you know, original or fresh or different or whatever, that really doesn't matter, as long as it's done its job. And if it's touched one or two people even, then it's done its job. You know, art speaks to us all in different ways, and it's all because we come from different walks of life, and we all have different experiences, and we all bring those experiences with us to whatever it is we're interpreting. So,
and we all like to be touched.
And we all like to be touched. We do. You know, ha ha, LOL, that's so dirty. But no, like, I was just talking about, I just got done watching The Haunting of Bly Manor, and a lot of people are kind of not, a lot of reviews of that have not been good. They're saying there's some story issues, whatever. There are certain touchstones in that series, without giving spoilers, that were very emotional for me. And yes, I knew there were some convoluted story issues. I honestly really didn't care. I knew what was going on, and I was emotionally moved by some of this because it's very, very sad. And I was like, okay, so I don't really care if it had some story holes. It talked to me, you know? And I also think that if you like a certain type of film, you shouldn't, or a certain type of genre, whatever, you know, unless somebody that you really respect is beating you with a stick going, this thing absolutely is so horribly bad, you shouldn't watch it, you should go ahead and watch it anyway and make up your own mind, because you don't know, maybe that film just rubbed that person the wrong way. You know, there is that too. But anyway, I digress.
So, what was the last, like, original story idea? I mean, the best I can come up with is probably Groundhog's Day, the whole time loop thing, because and that's become a subgenre of its own, right? With things like Edge of Tomorrow and the one with the
Happy Death
the killer.
Day.
Happy Death Day. Thank you. You know, so that's kind of that's not a thing. That's a thing that I'm 99% certain was born of people playing video games. Right. So, you know, dying and repeating, learning from that over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's the closest thing I can think of to an original story. And that's a movie that's now
old,
like 30 years old.
Yeah.
Old.
Yeah.
Well, and there is the Sixth Sense that I think was kind of right, where it's being told from the point of view of a ghost, but he doesn't know he's a ghost.
Right.
I think novel when it came out.
Blair Witch, right? That was novel.
Blair Witch, yeah. But I mean, there are these touchstones, like Mike said, of through time. But like which one of you had said earlier, but then when it's a new thing, it's only novel once and then it becomes its own thing. And now it's not novel anymore. And found footage is certainly that. You know?
Right. And even found footage is a matter of, and I guess, you know, I can even take that back with Groundhog's Day, right? Because found footage is a way of telling a story. It isn't the story.
Right. Right.
Blair Witch is still a Jason and the Argonauts quest story.
Yeah. I was just going to say, it bothers me a little bit when people refer to found footage as a genre, because it's not really a genre. It's a method of storytelling.
Right, like,
it happens to work really well for horror, but theoretically you could do a found footage comedy or a found footage drama. It's just a way of presenting it. It's not really its own genre.
Well, and it's kind of an offshoot of like the cinema verite, which I think was done in like the 60s. It's an offshoot of that.
Absolutely.
So technically, I guess it's like a style, right? Not really a genre. I don't know.
Exactly. Yeah.
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 Anyway, I don't know how we got there.
That was me.
Figures.
All my fault.
I think at this point is probably a good place to just kind of transition over to our interview with the director.
All right, so we are lucky enough to have a guest that actually is very important to our subject tonight, and that's the director of the film, Alone. So why don't you introduce yourself?
My name is John Hyams, and I'm actually just the director on this. The screenwriter is actually Matthias Olsen.
Yeah, okay, very good, very good. You found a pretty good script there then.
Yes.
To direct. All right, so... once again, we appreciate you joining us, and we have a bunch of questions for you, and I think we could start with you, Eric.
Okay. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
First question for you is that I noticed this is actually, unless my trivia note I have here is wrong, that this is a remake of a Swedish film called Gone by
Correct.
The same writer. So I was wondering how does that process work? Did you see that movie and want to remake it, or was it brought to you, or how did that whole process go?
So in the case of this one, it came to me as a script. And as you said correctly, the writer, Matthias Olsen, was the writer and co-director of the original. And him and his co-director on that one, Henrik Axelsson, they made this movie Gone in Sweden. And I think at a certain point they decided they were going to write a script to sell as an English language film, that they were not going to attach themselves as directors and try and shop it around. They hooked up with a producer named Mike McCary, and Mike's kind of specialized in bringing movies from overseas, and kind of remaking them in the States. One of his, I think most famously The Ring was a McCary movie that he had brought over, and a lot of kind of Asia movies from Asia he'd been doing this with. So Mike had, hooked up with the Swedes, as we call them. And, He got their scripts, and he's the one who got it to me. I didn't know Mike, but he had seen a movie that I had done. I think he had seen Universal Soldier: Day of Reckoning, which was the one that I had done that probably got the attention of most people in the industry. It was kind of a little cult thing amongst people within the industry. And eventually Mike reached out to me and got me the script. And at that time I had been doing some things that were really concentrated in the action genre, but I was really interested in something that really delved into just suspense and a thriller. And by the same token, I was also really my tastes and all my ideas at that time were kind of leading me more and more towards a minimalistic approach is something that I was starting to really want to kind of embrace deeper. I would read so many scripts that were overloaded with exposition and backstory that I felt were like these very contrived and in my mind, meaningless devices to kind of engender sympathy from the reader or the viewer in a particular character. And to me, it all felt so unnecessary and false. I always found that the best characters and character in life and in cinema is really revealed through behavior, not through dialogue, not through exposition. And, you know, an example that I always kind of always went back and looked at was one of my favorite movies of all time, which was Ridley Scott's original Alien.
Yes.
And you know, to me, it's just one of the best movies ever made. And it's one of the movies that made me want to be a filmmaker. And if you really think about Alien, you don't know anything about any of those characters. You don't know what their lives are like on Earth. You don't know if they're married, if they have kids. You don't know about the traumas in their life. You don't know if their dog died last week. You don't know anything. And there's nothing even in kind of their dialogue that makes any one character that much more radically different than the other ones in the first 40 minutes. But what happens is you meet a group of people, and throughout the course of the 2 hours, you see them under duress. And through that process, their character is revealed. Who's going to be a hero? Who's going to be a traitor? Who's going to be weak? Who's going to be strong? And that's the story, right? The story is who are these people and how do they behave? And so, you know, Ripley is not announced as the hero at the beginning of the movie. She's revealed to be the hero throughout the course of the movie. And to me, there's no greater character in cinema than Ripley. Everyone knows who Ripley is, and you just know her because of this one, watching her in this one experience, and how she handles it, how she handles all the things that are thrown at her. So I was inspired by her as a character. I was inspired by telling a story with a woman at the center of it. Maybe, I don't know, I had just had my second daughter. I'm surrounded by women. I'd also been making movies just all about men. And I'd grown up with two brothers. You know, that was like my life growing up. And I really wanted that other perspective. And some of my favorite characters and stories had often been women. I don't know if there was anything more about it than just that I was craving that. And then this script came along that really was doing all those things that I'm explaining to you guys. It kind of just, the first 50 pages of it, I was completely riveted. And so that's really how it all came about. It was kind of me looking for something and that thing kind of finding its way to me in the form of this script. And then we set about trying to make it, and that was in 2014, and we failed to get the money for it. And I we went our separate ways. They, I think it went to other directors, and eventually by 2017, I was able to get some money together and get it back to me. And that by that point in time, then we were able to kind of get out there and make it very quickly.
Fantastic. That's interesting about wanting to make a female-based movie. I have more questions about that later, but I'm going to give somebody else a turn to ask you a question now. I think Chrissy's up next.
Yeah, that's interesting that this was based on a Swedish film. And I recognize that you were the director and not the writer. But what one of the things I found very compelling about this movie is that there are five – this movie is split into five parts. And they represent the five parts of the emotional journey. There's like the road, you know, so that's like the introduction of her character and the and the beginning of the conflict. The river, which kind of represents the conflict basically in the story. The rain, where it's the first half of her crisis, where she's starting to come out of her crisis and realize, because like you said with Alien, we don't know what her past really is. It's, I do have a question about that later. Then the night, which is her low point. So that's the rock bottom, and then the clearing, and all of these items. I guess what I wanted to ask you is, it's clear to me, or it was clear to me, that in the script, these are all metaphors for her emotional journey. How did this come to you as a director? Like, was it already sort of written in the script that way? And if it, what kind of contributions did you make to kind of making those metaphors clearer? Did you like, for example, you have her wandering through this forest, right? This was set in a forest, which kind of echoes the complication of the mind. You know, we know she's got mental issues going on. We know there's guilt. We know she's very traumatized by her husband's death. So did it come to you packaged as a forest, a certain type of forest? Could this, in your opinion, have been set in a desert? Like, I guess what I'm trying to ask is, how much of the environment did you have control over in order to sort of make this emotional metaphor happen?
Well, it's a great question. And it is, and the reality is that that separating it that way was not actually in the script. That was something that we came upon a little bit later. And I think what ended up, you know, I was, it's something I've been interested in. Well, there's a couple ways of answering this question. From a formal standpoint, one of the things I loved about the movie, and it's another thing I've been exploring lately and now exploring very heavily in the my current project that I've been working on now, is the idea of things happening in real time and experiencing real time. And that, especially when it comes to suspense, being in a real time, you know, is the almost the greatest way of creating tension, when you're not compressing time in any way, and you're not, your point of view is essentially with one character, so you don't see what's around the corner. You know, these are great tools for creating suspense, and that's something that I think as I was making Alone, I was then making my show Black Summer, which is now, that one is completely a real-time show. And so the way to create real time is almost to create chapters and give it a structure like a novel, where, you know, you are in a chapter, you can experience complete real time, and then that chapter ends and then a new one starts, and you can shift through time through these chapters. But when you're in the chapter, you're staying in real time. When, while Alone is not strictly real time in that sense, a lot of it is, you know, a great deal of it. And as I started looking at the, not just the script, but how we were breaking the script down into how we were going to shoot it and the sections of the film, it just so happened that it seemed to really naturally fit into these five sections. And then in thinking about that, And that was almost a coincidence to a degree, because it really did naturally have five chapters to it. And the story, the internal story of this character, is, as you mentioned, is about a woman who's experienced grief, and she's coming to terms with this grief. And that the one thing that isn't an accident, I think, is baked into Matthias's script, is the idea that her external journey mirrors her internal journey, and her relationship with this grief. At first, she's running from it, and ultimately is forced to confront it in order to overcome it. And the idea that grief comes in five stages, right? There's the five stages of grief, you know, anger, denial, bargaining, depression, acceptance. And so we thought, well, and there was some early discussions with, you know, the producers, with Jonathan Rosenthal and myself, who I worked very closely with on this, you know, when there was some talk of should we name the chapters the different stages of grief? And I think while that's kind of an interesting idea, and it probably led us to what we ended up with, I felt like you really don't want to be so on the nose with it, because then you want the movie needs to be, any movie needs to have revelation, right? So if you started with the first chapter was anger, you know, or denial, then you're like, okay, it's going to be five chapters, it's going to be stages of grief. So how do we tell that story? How do we give the chapter names? How do we tell the whole thing through metaphor? And how do we don't have to necessarily be each one doesn't have to specifically mirror a stage of grief, but can be about her journey and her relationship with this grief, like the road that is, that she's fleeing from it, she's moving away. And of course, at the end of it, we end in the clearing, which just made metaphorical sense. So that's kind of the way that we came up with those titles again. And I think that that's, those were in line with just my approach to a lot of this, is that I wanted very simple chapter titles, the something, the, you know, something very physical and basic, and also something that, with a chapter title, you can say that the title of a chapter, and that is an interesting hook for the audience, right? Because we can call a chapter the river, right? But the river is, she's in a basement. So why is this called the river, right? So it almost, the title of a chapter has a narrative pull to it as well, because you're waiting to see literally how is this How is this title going to be justified? And so we messed with a bunch of different ones in the process, but ended up kind of honing it in on these specific ones. They just made sense. And I thought that they had, you know, there was resonance with these titles in terms of the metaphor, and also kind of narrative resonance. And also they just stayed in line with the very minimal, the kind of minimal approach to the whole thing, just two words, just like the movie. We couldn't have a title that had multiple words. It had to be one word, you know, is what it felt like. And so that's kind of how that was created. And then to answer your other question about whether it could have been a desert, it could have been another type of place, it could have been. And in fact, we originally, when we had the money and we were really thinking of making it, I mean, my first thought was, well, I'd just been out of town doing another thing. I was like, maybe we do the desert. I'm out, you know, I live in LA. Maybe we could do it out in LA, somewhere outside of here. And that would be, and we can make that work, you know, and that'll be a different approach. But the more I thought about it, the more I felt like that was not what was true, regardless of the original movie, because I really just watched the original movie one time after I got the script, and I never watched it again. And I just was basing it on the script. I felt like she needed to be completely shrouded by her environment, if that makes sense. That she there's something about, and that's why we chose the Pacific Northwest. There's something about that landscape is simultaneously kind of beautiful and awe-inspiring, but also very, very threatening and menacing if you imagine being just stuck in the middle of that. And no one could, there's no way that anyone could see you for miles. For something about the lack of visibility of being in the woods versus being in a desert where you can see things for miles. So if someone's coming for you, you can see them, you know? So it was about putting her in this environment where everywhere she looked, she's surrounded by barriers that not only can someone else hide, but she can hide in. And it suddenly that environment became very important. So that's why we went to basically Portland to shoot.
Well, thank you very much. That really was an awesome answer. And that was really enlightening. And I'm so glad to hear that that was kind of something that was sort of coming up as you guys were developing, because I was really impressed with that. I was like, I've never seen a movie that's kind of done this, where they've sort of paralleled with the environment and the chapters, the basic, you know, character conflict, crisis, change pattern. And I just really thought that was so well done. So thank you. Great.
Thank you.
All right, Mike, you're up.
All right. So first of all, I think you're one of us, because not only did you love Alien, but you dropped unintentionally a running joke on the podcast by calling them all Swedes, because that goes to a line from The Thing that we always quote. We're all Swedes. I really like the cast. Now, this is, other than some voice work and a few other things, you're for the most part a three character film. Right. So the three leads, well, the two leads are Jules Wilcox and is it Mark Menchaca?
Correct.
Okay. And then one of my favorite character actors you had on there is Anthony Held, or Heald. Yes. I never know how to pronounce that. So how did you find them working with them? I thought they all did a really, really good job with this. Could you talk about, like, how do you go about, how did you find them? How did you cast them? How did you work with them?
So in the case, you know, obviously the first character that we needed to cast was Jessica. And Jules Wilcox was someone that I had worked with once and made an extreme impression on me. And it's I'll tell the story because it's pretty interesting. But, you know, I had been at that time, I was doing a lot of just kind of episodic TV directing gigs, you know, to pay the bills. So I would do network TV shows and things like that, and was, you know, good jobs to have. And I was doing a particular show in Chicago, like a cop show. And there was we had a day of shooting where I was going to work with this actress, Jules Wilcox, who I didn't cast. She had already been cast before me because I think she had recurred on a few different couple episodes. And this day of shooting was one of those things that you do in episodic TV where you have one actor and you got to pack all their scenes into one day. And it's like, it was like four scenes on a hospital set. And in the story, she is been the victim of a violent, horrible, violent crime. And as is always the case in TV, you never have any time to shoot stuff. Even on the big budget shows, this one had a very healthy budget. It's an NBC show. But this actor had four scenes. Each scene is kind of more emotionally wrought than the next. You know, she's being rushed to the hospital after this horrible, you know, violent, attack. And then the next scene is her recounting the attack, you know, tearfully with her sister. And the next one is her being reunited with her daughter. And now she has to live with this horrible trauma in her life. And, you know, there was like four scenes. Any one of these scenes you'd spend a whole day shooting on, if this was a movie. But because it's TV, she's got to do all four of them in one day. And each one is just more difficult than the next for an actor. And what I, as we started going, is I don't know this actor, and I'm thinking, my God, what is she, you know, what are we going to get from this? She's just going to have to kill herself over and over. And on TV shows too, you have to cover these scenes from so many angles. So she's going to have to do every one of these scenes 15 times. And what I saw was just this incredible display of acting chops, basically, where, you know, this was a theater trained person and she came in and just nailed every one of these scenes, one after another, one more emotional than the next, turning on, you know, she could, and it's not just about crying at will, but she could do that take after take after take. And she could hit these long monologues and hit all the beats. And it was truly impressive. I had rarely seen an actor. Usually you kind of give them a couple takes and that's all you get. The well is dry and you hope you got it. She just did it take after take after take, scene after scene, and doing so well that we were finished. We were finishing early. I think it was like about 11:30 p.m. And we've been going all day. And I thought, wow, that was amazing. And we're on our last setup, and one of the camera assistants comes over to me, and he's whispering something to the DP, who then comes to me and says, I don't know how to tell you this, but something happened with the card, and we lost everything. We've lost everything we've shot.
Oh, and, Jesus.
I thought, oh, wow. Okay. Well, you know, I guess should we reschedule? Are we going to do this another day? And you know, the producer comes over and they said, no, we got to get this done tonight. So basically I had to walk back on there and tell her that we'd been shooting for probably 12 hours. We got to do it all again now, at 11:30 at night. And I walked in there and told her, and I think she laughed and kind of took a deep breath and said, all right. And we did it. We did all those scenes again. And she hit all those beats again every single time. And it was one of those cases where, you know, this is a random episode of a random network show. No one's going to see it. But it was a case where I witnessed a feat of acting prowess. You know, it was like acting Olympics. The combination of talent, strength, stamina, every will, fortitude. I just thought, wow, that was one of the most impressive things I've ever seen a performer do in my whole life. And I got to work with this person again. I don't know when it will happen, but I just have to remember this person. And when this script came around and we're getting ready to make it, I said, I know the person who can do this. And she's the only person I know who can do this. And I gave her name early, and of course her name carried no weight. And so we had to go all, you know, talk to a lot of actors about it and go down the road with a lot of people. But eventually, you know, we were able to bring it back to her and called her within weeks of shooting. And she came out there and it was a very arduous shoot, and a lot of things went down during the shoot that make it even more arduous. And she you know, she proved her mettle. I mean, she's just one of the toughest people I know. And I think, you know, just a beautiful talent and incredible actor. So that's how she came about. And Mark Menchaca was a little bit of a simpler process. Our casting director, we had been going up and down trying to find the right person for that role. And it was the kind of thing where you're going to cast for the serial killer, you're going to cast for the guy next door. You know, if you go too far either direction, it doesn't quite work. We needed someone who really could straddle that line. And Sari Knight, we were having a lot of trouble with that and getting close to shooting. And she had mentioned, what about Mark Menchaca? And I had just seen him in that season of Ozark. I've been aware of him. We both have a close mutual friend in the actor, Michael Kelly, who did House of Cards and, you know, and a lot of things that you'd know him from. And they had worked together on a David Simon show called Generation Kill for HBO. And when she mentioned Menchaca, I thought, yeah, we got to have that guy. And I reached out to Michael Kelly. I said, we got no money. Can you convince Mark Menchaca to do our movie? And Michael put a call into him, and I guess he did the job. Michael's very, you know, he's an amazing guy, so you trust him. And again, that was an incredible find too, because Mark Menchaca.
I was going to ask you why he got a special thanks.
Yeah, exactly. No, he made it happen. He's the reason for Mark, and it, you know, I think in a movie like this, you need. It's almost like a when you're doing a romantic comedy, you need your actors who fall in love. They need to have chemistry. But for this movie, these two needed to have chemistry together for it to work. You know, they really are dance partners through the whole thing. And I think it really worked out well. I mean, they're both, you know, beautiful people, and they're just. Mark is, they're both really fun people. And Mark's like the most, you know, he's the life of the party. And Jules is, you know, is a blast and loves to laugh. And they just had a lot of laughs and a lot of fun. And they loved each other and really trusted each other. And you kind of need that for something that's as physical and emotionally wrought as this. So that's how they, you know, that's how they came about. And with Anthony, that was through the casting director as well. I was thrilled that we got him. I've always been a big fan.
I mean, I think most of us know him originally from Silence of the Lambs.
Right? Exactly.
Might have been the first thing most of us saw him with.
Exactly.
And I remember he was on Boston Public playing the vice principal, which was a completely different kind of asshole. But
that's right. That's right. So, he plays a good guy in this, and he is.
Yeah, he's like a good guy. Yeah.
He's a real sweetheart, and that's what he is.
Yeah, and what I like is that, you know, we've seen similar films like this before. Woman in Jeopardy is not exactly a new story. So I was very happy to see he was just kind of a stand-up guy. Because a lot of times now the cliche is to try to force a twist on you.
Right.
And so it's that, oh, he's there to help her. And then it turns out he's really working with the villain the whole time. And
right.
It brings her back to him or something. So I was very glad he is exactly what he appears to be.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly.
But, a little sad that he didn't make it further into the film.
Oh yeah, no, and I thought that was what was kind of, you know, clever in the original script too, is that it's playing upon those expectations, right? Like, you know, we've all seen this movie 100 times different ways, and so we're kind of playing on the audience expectation, is like, wait a minute, are these two guys in cahoots? What's the deal? And those expectations help the suspense.
Yeah. All right, I have a question. And speaking of Mark Menchaca of Ozark, everybody drink. That's another one of our running jokes, because I always promote Ozark. I say Ozark's the best show. So, but I thought of this question this afternoon because at the time I didn't know you were one of the showrunners, writers, and directors of Black Summer until this afternoon when we were talking. And I noticed now the similarities between this film here alone and I think it's episode 5, Diner, where there's a sociopath, Philip, in that one. And then, of course, the man that Mark plays. And then you have a survivor, generally a normal person, maybe has some problems, as we discussed, in Jessica. And then we have Sun, who was probably a refugee from North Korea, so she has, you know, backstory, has problems and whatnot. And
exactly.
Then William, who is alone from his family in Texas. And I wanted to know, even though you didn't write this, you did write the Diner episode. You're in this film and that episode, you have people that want to survive, really survive, and then you also have the sociopath who is out to get them some way. And I wanted to know, did you carry over from the Diner episode your writing or thoughts on sociopaths and survivors to add to what Olson wrote in the script, or was this something that you just kind of fell, I guess, into easily because of the diner?
Well, no, actually, the reality is that, as I was saying before, I think Alone was kind of the beginning of moving in a sort of a direction for things for me. And in fact, we shot Alone we were shooting Alone before I even wrote Black Summer, in fact. And Alone, the shoot had to stop and start because of a whole story with an injury on set that we had to break up the shooting there was two parts to the shoot. So I was kind of going that way. So when I was creating Black Summer and coming up with how the whole season was going to be structured, that was, again, I was in this idea of doing the chapters and stuff. So episode 5, well, it's interesting that you even compared to that. I like that. I never thought of that. Usually the episode that people would more likely compare it to would be episode 4, which was, I always thought of was kind of, it's the guy Lance and the zombie. To me, episode 4 was kind of like my version of Duel with, you know, one guy, one monster. That's the whole thing, you know, and there have been other shows that have done versions of that. Like I remember that there was that great Black Mirror episode, the Metalhead one, that is this very simple Duel like kind of story. So
is that the one with the dog?
Yeah, the little like mechanical dog that's chasing the woman around. Yeah. So in many ways, I feel like that episode has a lot of similarities to Alone. But now that you break it down, you mentioned the diner episode. I think that there is definitely some thematic ones. I mean, and that episode to me, that was kind of the show is all about people. You know, it's kind of moving through space. It's kind of a road show, and I wanted to do this one confined episode, kind of the, you know, we were calling it our 12 Angry Men episode, where you confine a bunch of characters and then the tension starts kind of ratcheting up as you go. And I felt like, I mean, it's interesting. I like that you see the Phil character as a psychopath. I almost saw him as a when people are under duress, as we say, we don't know anything about the guy, but we experience a situation where a bunch of characters are under duress, and how are people going to behave? In fact, the arguments that he makes in that episode, I think, are pretty sound arguments. Like, he's not wrong in what he's saying, but he's not being a humanist, right? He's thinking as, you know, as a Darwinist. And I think that Black Summer is really about the collision of those two kind of forces, those two, and season 2 takes it much, much further in terms of, you know, the show is not really about finding a cure or about, you know, what's the cause of this. It's more about, this is happening. How does everybody react? And what, you know, do we descend into, you know, savagery? Do we become cavemen? Or can we still maintain our humanity and solve this crisis, you know? And so I think this show deals with people who are constantly having to make those choices. And that's kind of what I think is interesting about the subject for me. You know, it's less about zombies. You know, I don't even have any particular interest in zombies in any particular genre way. I mean, I've liked a couple of movies. Like I loved, you know, Zack Snyder's Dawn of the Dead, and I loved 28 Days Later, but it's not like I'm necessarily a devotee of the genre. But I thought it was a great way to explore, you know, humanity.
Nice, yeah. Eric.
All right. I want to go back to what you said about going in a direction to have a female-centric movie. Because something I noticed when watching this movie, as you mentioned previously, we've seen the female in peril before. But this movie, I think, is the only one that's ever made me feel like I might know a little bit what it's like to be a female alone in a circumstance where there's some dude that you don't know, and that's scary. And I'm wondering how much of that was intentional, how much of that came out of the script, how much of that was your intention. Did you do any research talking to the women in your life? How much of it was Jules? I'm just wondering how that vibe came about, because I really think it's effective that you get that feeling.
Well, I really think that Matthias had really captured that in his script. And it is what I responded to in the script, because to me, it wasn't a typical female in peril story. And that wasn't really what was interesting to me. What was interesting to me is a story of a person who's ultimately forced to become the hero of the story, forced to do things that are heroic, but that it doesn't mean that these things are superhuman, that this is not a superhero. This is a very real person. How can we put ourselves through these the paces of this character and you know, really ground it in as much reality as we can, and see how does this character, A, in the front half of the movie, how does the character find himself in this really challenging situation, not because of her own foolishness or naivete, but in fact, a character who is exhibiting kind of the caution that we as the audience are often yelling at the screen about, and that she's on to the guy just as early as we're on to them. And in fact, she feels guilty about her paranoia, which feels like a very natural human emotion, that when he's trying to kind of set the trap for her, she's not falling for the trap. And she is in some ways questioning whether she's being a bad person by doing that, by being paranoid. So I love that Matthias's script kind of dealt with these things that, frankly, I don't think just women deal with, but people in general, when we're constantly kind of oscillating between a state of caution, but then when are we being too cautious in life, and when can we, you know, not worry about things, whatever they may be.
Right. Where's the line between being cautious and being a jerk?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Exactly. So that stuff, I thought that, you know, Matthias had really baked that into the character on the page. And I thought it was a really, he had already created someone, again, to me, without telling me all about this person, just the way she behaved, she felt like a real person to me. And of course, Jules is going to fill that person out with who she is, as any actor is going to bring kind of their essence and their vibe. And that's going to be the character as much as anything on the page. But so I think it's really a combination of what Matthias had put on the page and the way that Jules chose to portray her. I think that's really the strength of that character. And it was, it was my job just not to mess it up.
well done. I thought it was quite effective.
Oh, I'm glad. Thank you.
One of the scenes I really liked is, you know, you guys were just talking about it earlier, the scene where the hunter picks her up and she gets a sandwich and some water, and there was that scene, and then this scene when she has the cell phone in the back of the killer's car a little bit later. Both scenes, I thought, were really effective in that I was really so nervous watching both of those scenes. I was very nervous that the guy was going to jump out of the woods any second and, like, attack the car with the hunter. And then, of course, I was like, oh, my God, that guy would, especially when he was looking for a cell phone, the killer. I was like, oh, no, he's gonna figure out she's in the car. I really thought that the shooting of that was deliberate. The way that we were focused on his face, the way that we were peering out through the windshield. Are those types of shots standard for creating that sort of tension? Or does using cinematography like that, in other words, is that dictated by the environment or the type of film? Or are those like tried and true techniques, I guess is what I'm asking. Because that was really fascinating in how it elicited that response in me. And I was just curious if those are things that have been done or if they really do change based on who the cinematographer is, the director is, what kind of environment you're in.
Well, it's a really good question. And I think it comes, of course, you plan your approach with your cinematographer, and our cinematographer on this, Federico Verardi, I think did a beautiful job with capturing things in a, I would say the best word I could describe it was in a very kind of delicate way. He created, those are the kind of words I would use with him. Let's create a very delicate environment, because if it's a delicate environment, then we will disrupt that. You know, we will disrupt these kind of frames and these images that have tension baked into them. So, you know, whether it's because the image is very steady or static, or maybe the image is we're not cutting for a while. So all of those things come into consideration. But I think the main consideration, and this is how I think about anything when I'm reading it or when I'm writing it or when I'm planning it, is the first question I think as a director you ask yourself is, what's the point of view right now? Whose point of view is this from? And in the case of Alone, almost always the point of view is Jessica, which means the camera kind of moves with her. And so when she is in the back of the car, then we have one angle that is looking down upon her in the back. And she's a little bit concealed. It's cutting her face in half, which means she's hiding, but she's not hiding that well. She could easily be, she could be discovered very easily. And then what's the other angle? Well, the other angle is really from the back looking forward. So that's a consideration, right? Because you can shoot the driver from many different ways. You can shoot the driver through the windshield. You could shoot the driver, you know, on either profile. You could shoot him frontal. We decided that let's put the camera looking at him from behind. So you're seeing what the movement through the windshield, and we're essentially looking at the back of his head, because that's where she is. So it's a very simple thing, but if you apply that to every moment in the whole story, you know, who's this point of view with? At times, the point of view in our story, actually, when we originally conceived it, it was always going to be with her. And then as we move forward, we decided we're going to actually let him have the point of view sometimes too. We're going, because part of this story is not only her struggle, part of the story is his struggle, right? He's having a really bad day. Like, things didn't go the way he wanted. And so he's having the worst day of his life. And we should honor that, because now we really have these two characters whose goals are opposing each other, right? They're standing in they're both standing in the way of each other's goals. So that's drama, that's conflict. So in sometimes giving him the point of view, then for instance, when she is walking to the car, about to get into that car, we can also cut to him digging the grave or shoveling dirt on the grave, right? We're not just playing that from her point of view in the car looking out at him. We do play that, but we can also go to him. And then those points of views will converge. So usually where you're putting the camera, first and foremost, at least for me, I mean, everyone has their way of doing things. But for me, I like to think of whose perspective is this from? And to me, for something like this, telling a story subjectively, meaning you are with the character. We only know as much as the characters know. We never cut to, the state police getting the call. Oh, there's a woman's missing. Let's send a helicopter. You know, we don't do that scene in this movie because we don't know if anyone's looking for her and we don't want to know. You know, that's going to break the tension rather than create more. So that's kind of how those considerations are made in the scene with her and Tony Heald where they're driving. That was very much about, we're looking out the windshield of the car, right? Because they're moving through the woods. We know the guy's out there somewhere. So anytime we look at that point of view, we're aware of him. And then we also cut to these shots of these dual kind of close-ups where the camera is mounted outside the car looking in, so you see the reflection of the trees on the windshield, which again is reminding you of the trees, and the trees represent this guy is out there somewhere. So the trees became an important kind of thematic visual and also audio thing. The creaking of the trees, that became an audio motif that we would play with a lot to remind you that's he's out there somewhere, and that she's also lost. She's in the middle of these trees. They've kind of swallowed her up. So I think that's pretty much the thought process that goes into how to break the scenes down.
Thank you. Yeah, I did like the fact that the trees were creaking, and also like when she was in the house, there was also creaking of the boards too, which was interesting. Yeah. And how those two things sort of paralleled each other, sort of the contrast between claustrophobia and whatever the opposite of claustrophobia is. Like, it's so large, it's overwhelming, you know what
right.
I mean? So
it's yeah. Exactly right.
That
exactly
is really
right.
Cool.
All right. Very good. Mike.
Okay. One of the things I liked about it, I don't know if this is going to overlap with your previous answer, is there the naturalism, right? Like, so, for example, when Jessica's evolution is very natural, there's no sudden moment where she becomes a superwoman, which sometimes you see. I always think back to that with Nancy in the first time Erin Elm Street movie, where she suddenly kind of turns into Rembet. But also things like the fight in the car. You know, it's not overly stylized. That's what gives it a sense of real. Well, that, and they're in a moving car. There's a sense of real jeopardy. It's very plausible. It's very believable. Whereas for a lot of films, and it's perfectly valid choice, but we'll go for more of a stylized, heightened sense of reality. You know, where the action's a little bigger, the fights are a little more dramatic. You know, and you keep it more grounded. And by the way, since Phil brought up Black Summer, it also goes back to a lot of the stuff I think you did there, you know. So right. How do you approach that to make sure when you're filming that things are grounded, that they're real, that they're plausible? Is that something that you intentionally do? Is it just something just happens to be the way you do it?
Well, how does that work? Yeah, I think, you know, at a certain point it comes down to taste, but I've also worked on things where the reality's been a little more heightened at times, but I think in the end, you know, I started out in documentaries and I realized how effective the drama that occurs in a documentary, how when you know something's really happening and these are real people, it moves you in a much deeper way. And I felt that there's plenty of examples out there and plenty of ways of people making movies and telling stories where you have heightened reality, where you kind of create a comic book reality, and a lot of those are really fun to watch, you know. And so I have nothing against that, but I feel like, to me, certainly with this movie and certainly with Black Summer, it became really important that we didn't fall. We always resisted the temptation to heighten something, to stylize it, to suddenly make the character become a superhero, or to make a piece of action more spectacular. I felt like sometimes it's so much more effective to underplay it. If you can remind the audience, if they can relate to something, it's like watching a fight in a movie, right? Where, let's say the Rock is fighting Vin Diesel. I mean, that's as much, yeah, that's fun, right? And it's some spectacular stunt work, and it's all pretty low stakes because we're not really worried for anyone, but we're going on a ride, a visual, you know, kind of sensory ride. But anyone who's ever been in a real fight, or more importantly, anyone who's ever seen a real fight, you know, and witnessed one, it's actually far more intense and violent without people crashing through windows and tumbling downstairs and hanging onto girders and stuff. Just watching two people fight from full body wide, it is a really intense, you know, dramatic thing. And I remember I did a documentary, my first documentary that ended up being an HBO thing. This is now, you know, almost 18 years ago, now 17 years ago when it came out. It was called The Smashing Machine, and it was in the MMA world back when that was, you know, before it became as big as it is now, and it was banned in a lot of states. So the fighters would go to Japan to make their money. So we went to Tokyo to cover a lot of these fights with our subject. And the thing that's really interesting in Tokyo, or in Japan in general, is that they get huge crowds for these fights. You know, back then they would fight in the Tokyo Dome. There'd be 50,000 seat arenas. They love fighting and martial arts and warrior culture. So they have these huge crowds, but when the bell rings, the place goes dead silent. You can hear a pin drop. And when you suddenly are hearing the sound of these guys' feet on the canvas, and you can hear and we're ringside filming these, and you can hear every punch and every body, you know, every body impact. And there was something about hearing the fights without any sound, without, you know, or without crowd screaming and music. It was suddenly so much more filled with so much more tense than if it was really loud and noisy. And so I realized that, like, I think reality or naturalism or realism on some level, I think that affects us in a much more visceral way than stylization. I think stylization stimulates other emotions in us, and it can be fun, and it can kind of satisfy some kind of aspirational idea of violence. But to me, it's much more interesting to present it as real in all its kind of awkwardness and ugliness, because I feel like that, especially in the case of this is a thriller. So you're trying to create suspense and tension. And I feel like a real fight like the fight at the end, which isn't particularly spectacular. It's not like a, it's not a beautiful piece of choreography. It's pretty much two people rolling around in the mud and just clawing and grabbing at each other. But to me, that the result of that's going to be more cathartic, because we're really witnessing two people trying to kill each other. So I think that's, at this point, that's now just become where my taste has led me, and Black Summer for sure, because again, you really have to resist the temptation in a zombie genre thing to make everyone's a great shot. Everyone can shoot someone in the head from 50 yards away, and everyone, and you can almost turn it into comedy or into to kind of a fun thing so easily. And I always say with Black Summer, we have to treat this as if, you know, pretend like one of these infected people is a mountain lion, and a mountain lion is running after you. You know, what are you going to do? Are you, if you have a gun and a mountain lion's running after you, do you have extreme confidence that you could point that gun and shoot him right in the head? Or are you just going to get the hell out of there and run and seek shelter? And if you really thought about that, I think you would try and get out of there rather than fight the thing. And so that's,
I think, was it the diner episode, if I remember correctly, where they sneak out the back and I think he hits or tries to hit one of the zombies from behind.
Right. Yes.
And doesn't kill him, and he turns around and just, you know, scrambles like a scared rabbit, right?
Yeah.
Because it's the Walking Dead cliche, right? They one hit in the head with a frying pan and they'd be taken out.
Right. Exactly.
But in this case, it doesn't.
That's right. That episode was about there's five of them inside, and there's two of these zombies outside, and. But if you imagine, if you were trapped in a diner, there's two mountain lions outside or two bears, would you like your chances against them with five people? Probably not, right? Unless you really had the right weaponry. So again, that was all an effort to kind of show you how hard it might be to do that. So that when they're finally able to do it at one point in time or another, that it's really earned. You know, and so it's the same, I think, in Alone is trying to, if you violate that naturalism at any point in time, it'll set the whole thing off balance. So you really have to be, every day over, you know, we're shooting right now, every day on set, we're faced with those things. Cause it could be like, we just had that on set the other day. It was like a big long sequence, and it was this pretty amazing, you know, action sequence with this guy dealing with all these hazards. And at the end, one of them is just running to him, and he's got a gun. And, you know, the first takes that they were doing, the thing runs up and he shoots him one shot to the head and the thing goes down. And it was a perfect button to the scene, right? It was like perfect. He's so exhausted. The thing runs at him and he picks it up and boom, drops it. But, you know, I was thinking about it, I said, I know it's a really cool way to end it, but it's just too lucky that I think he's got to shoot three times and hit him once, you know? So we changed it. We said, you're right. It's just too superhero-y. Let him go and fire a few times and finally hit him. That at least we can maintain this sense of naturalism that we've worked so hard to maintain. So there is plenty of temptation to fall out of it, but I think it's a mistake if you do so.
Now, I actually like that analogy about the pumas or the black bears outside comparing the zombies to them, because yeah, I wouldn't want to go out if it was bears or pumas, but so that makes a good point. When I was watching, I was like, oh, just go out. But yeah, it's a really good point. I did have a question about Mark, his character again, and the man, and there's a scene where obviously he's a total sociopath or psychopath in the basement and actually enjoys obviously being a psychological torturer, and yet the very next scene that he's in, he's on the phone as the businessman, normal family man, father that he is back in his home state. And I was curious if Matthias or yourself were basing that split personality of this serial killer with any live or real cases that may have influenced the if not the writing, at least the presentation of the man in this movie.
Well, you know, I don't know specifically who Matthias was thinking about, but to me, the one that has always really struck me was the BTK killer.
Oh, yeah.
You remember that guy?
Sure do, yeah.
Yeah, because he had a family. You know, he had a daughter. He was a guy in the neighborhood who people knew. He was not like some crazed recluse. So to me, there was something really terrifying about that idea. And I think that that was Mark's way of tapping into the guy, which I thought was very smart. And it's what he said about it, was that he thought of it as this guy has an addiction. And I think that makes a lot of sense, you know, so that it's kind of impossible just to play a psychopath, but you can play a person who has a compulsions that he hides from everyone in his life, and those compulsions are very destructive. So he could play that, and I thought that definitely rings true for some, you know, people. I mean, Ted Bundy is another one that people mentioned. I mean, Ted Bundy had, you know, a girlfriend and things like that. He had another life and was a seemingly presentable guy. So I think it wasn't one particular real person, but it was like, it's more definitely more in the BTK model than the Son of Sam model, let's say.
Right, yeah. All right, we've been recording for an hour, but I don't know if we could keep you until 9 o'clock, if that would work.
Yeah.
That's okay?
No. Yeah, for sure.
Oh, great, okay. Eric, what do you got, my friend?
Well, this is my actual question, but I was just curious. Are you familiar with the Lewis Clark Valley Killer?
No. Who is that?
Well, they haven't officially caught him. The Lewis Clark Valley Killer. It was up in the Pacific Northwest. That's why I asked.
Oh, no, I'm not.
Phil and I recently watched a documentary about that, and it's really interesting because they never caught the guy. Everybody's pretty sure they know who it is. In the documentary we watched, they won't mention his name because it's the police and they don't want to get sued. But if you look it up online, everybody's pretty sure they know who it is. But he's still out there. He moved out of town, but he never got caught for anything.
Wow.
So that crossed my mind while I was watching that alone. But my actual question for you is, while I was watching the movie, I thought I watched it right before we started recording tonight. And I thought I caught something. So you can answer this yes or no, or if there's a story, you can tell the story. But there's one shot during the fight scene in the car where all of a sudden there's a shot from outside the car, and there's a tree in between the car and the camera, and the car looks like it's going off the road, and it looks like it's going to hit the tree, and then there's a cut to show the car rolling over in the road. My question is, did the car actually hit the tree and or the camera?
So, well, yeah, that's a great question. The answer is yes, it hit the tree, so which is good, because if it didn't hit the tree, it would have hit the camera. And basically what happened was, I mean, if you rewatch that moment, it's pretty interesting. We were going to do this stunt. It was a little wet out. It had been raining. And the sun was going down, and the stunt guys had set up a little ramp for the so that they could roll the right tire off, kind of old Dukes of Hazzard type of trick,
right,
and just kind of roll the car that way. And so they set it up, and in that actual moment, I was operating one of the cameras myself. There was the camera that was kind of right near the ramp, so the car is going to take off, and I'm going to see it kind of go through the air, turn over, and it's going to land in that road and slide. And then Fetty was on the camera down below on the long lens, the one you're talking about with the tree there. It was not supposed to be going in that direction. It was supposed to be going far right of that tree and landing in the road. So then when the car goes, the guy, the stunt driver, basically missed the ramp. He was supposed to get his right tire on the ramp. He ended up, the right tire went past the ramp. But it was enough, I guess, they hit the ramp enough, I guess, maybe just with the underside of the undercarriage of the car to flip it over. But if you see that first shot, the one that I'm operating, and that's a wide lens, you'll see how close those tires actually came to the camera. It just buzzed right by me, probably 15 feet off course.
Wow.
It's not supposed to be that close. And as you can see, it's heading straight for the camera below. The camera guys all bailed out. And fortunately, it just slammed into that tree that was right there. And that stopped it from just plowing through the camera. And worse, if the guys were still there, I mean, it could have been really bad. So that was like the first take at that. And so we had to go back and do the stunt again the next day, and we did, and we successfully got it over. But in looking back, I thought that those two angles were actually pretty dynamic, so I still included them editorially into the thing going over. But if you look closely, you're right; it's totally off course.
I didn't notice it until the second view, so doesn't stick out like a sore thumb, but since I already knew what was going on with the story, I was like, hey, wait a minute.
Yeah, no. You're totally right. But it's sometimes those mistake shots, I mean, it's cool if you scrutinize it, you could see it. But some of the best things that some of the best shots are from a continuity perspective completely off. But I never have a problem putting them in there because it's really how you're perceiving these images as they happen. If you cut a movie strictly to continuity, it would be a very dull movie. You're pushing continuity all the time because it doesn't matter. If you notice it the first time you watch it and everyone notices it, then it's a problem. But if you don't notice it that first time, then sometimes it can be really, it's just the most energy in that image or whatever's going on. I mean, there's plenty of great examples of it. I mean, one of my favorite moments is like in Goodfellas when Spider gets shot. You know that moment?
Oh yeah.
You guys know about that? When Michael Imperioli gets shot?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah, absolutely. Hey, Spider, get me a drink, Spider.
Yeah, Spider. Yeah, you prick. You know, that whole thing.
Yeah,
so,
yeah, that whole bit.
Well, if you watch that, I mean, watch the moment because basically he's like, I don't know if you can, he's like, he's Tommy's making fun of his foot and he's like, yeah, hey, Tommy, why don't you go fuck yourself? Something like that. And they're like,
oh, you hear what he said to you.
Oh, you gotta let him do that. That whole thing. So the shot of Spider right before he fires the gun, he's behind the bar. And then they cut quickly to Joe Pesci, lifts the gun, boom, 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 and he's in front of the bar and gets nailed. Obviously, the scene went on a little longer, and he probably was behind the bar, and then he walked out in front. But Scorsese is the king, and that's who I probably learned this from. He pays no attention to continuity editorially, and that's, his editing is purely based on emotion and energy, and you don't notice that Spider's behind the bar because when he lifts up the gun and firing, you've forgotten everything at that moment. But that's a good one. And you could watch Scorsese movies all the time. And there's all sorts of these continuity things. And to me, I think they're great. That shows what balls he has in the way he tells a story and why his movies are so, the editing is incredible. He's one of the best. I know he's not the official editor, but you know, it's Thelma, but Scorsese's an editor, and you know he is just from watching his movies.
Yeah, and he has the final word, obviously, too.
It's yeah, Scorsese. and you can just tell he's an editor, you know, and I think he started out that way, and it's very clear because his movies are defined, I think, more even, I mean, as much from the just the camera and the way the camera behaves, but the way he cuts is so distinctive.
Right, and I've long said if you're on the first watch, I understand if you're on your fourth or fifth watch is one thing.
Right.
If you're on your first watch and you're noticing continuity errors, then the director screwed up somewhere because you're not engrossed in the film.
That's correct.
And the continuity error is not the problem. The problem is that you have not engaged the audience. Again, you're going to be less engaged on your fifth viewing of the movie, you know. but that's fine because I still think that so much of how you enjoy a film is echoing your first viewing experience.
Yeah.
You know, so if you would really, so it's, if you really, really enjoyed that first viewing experience, you'll always carry that with you. And if you pick up little things later on, it's really not going to bother you.
I think so too. And sometimes those, again, I see those things as also good. It's like you're further discovering some of, you know, you're just seeing it in a deeper way. And a lot of times you'll work with an editor and they'll take a lot of those things out. And I'm always like, no, put it back. Not just because you're putting a mistake in, but it's because like, this performance is better. And yes, she's holding the cigarette in the wrong hand and her hair is in her face, but the motion of this moment is better. And if we set it up right, you're not going to notice, you know, and so you ultimately are just trying to put together all the moments that have the right energy and the right feeling, even if they're out of bounds continuity wise.
Right. All right.
Cool.
Yeah. Hey, Tommy, but you shoot the guy. You're going to dig this your own hole tonight. That was an awesome film. The best. Yeah. Chrissy, you got a question?
It's more of a comment. But yeah, there is kind of a question. I thought the title alone, you had mentioned it earlier on, is really interesting because it not only suggests the external circumstances of both of these characters and that they are both alone externally, but that they're also very alone internally. You know, neither of these characters can really relate to the outside world. In the end, we're just inside our own bodies with our own battles and our own demons, and we're basically inside ourselves. That said, I really liked the contrast between the main character and her aggressor. That, you know, there's that stunning moment where she overhears him on the cell phone talking to his family. And that moment was so powerful because here he is, he's all calm and he's nice and he's sounding like he's just this ordinary dude on a business trip making a deal. And I thought that that might be speaking to another one of the themes of this film, in that there are two sides to every story, and that we don't always know who other people really are inside. And I thought it made the viewer stop and think about everybody we know, and if we do truly know who they are. And so I think that right now is kind of an interesting contemporary comment on what's happening in the world at the moment. So in your opinion, or when you were making this movie, did you think that the title was not only about them being externally alone, but also internally?
Well, yes, I think that was how we came upon that title. And it's interesting. The title of the original Swedish movie is Gone, right? Or the translation of the word Gone. And that was originally what the originally when the script that I received was called Gone. And I like that title, but we kind of were thinking about it and thinking about maybe different titles. And all during the time when we were shooting, it was just called Untitled Thriller, you know? So even our crew, we had like crew jackets that said Untitled Thriller. But we came upon, it's kind of funny, if you read the Hollywood Reporter today, there's a funny article actually about this, about all these movies titled Alone, and where they, I did it like an interview with this guy about it. It's kind of funny. But we came upon that title for the reasons you're saying, which is why we really liked it, even though, yes, it's a title that, you know, there's going to be other movies titled Alone. But A, I wanted something so simple that's it, that that is just one word, that it's a simple word that that is extremely general, in the same way that the river, the road, you know, those kind of things, so that it kind of stayed. You couldn't have a multi-word title. And then, yeah, and then of course, Alone, it sort of worked on multiple levels, like you say, not just about her, but also about him too, right? That he's having a very, you know, he's alone. He's all alone in the world, this guy too. He's that we can be a part of a group of people. We can be part of families. We can, you know, we can be part of communities, but in the end, right, we are the person that we really are. It is only exists between our ears. And in the case of this story, you have this one guy who is, when we get down to his essence, he's a defective, you know, dysfunctional person. And in the case of her, what her essence is that she is this person of incredible fortitude, and she can survive. She's has this reservoirs of strength and power in a believable way, in a human way, that in a way that people can demonstrate these things. And so we really felt like, despite the fact that this is a title that is, you know, can be the title of many things, we liked its utter generality, and I think that's why we chose it.
It's kind of funny that you brought up Alone, because when we were talking about the film, I kept on telling everybody, make sure it's the one that's directed by a guy named Hyams, because there's one there's another 2020 Alone, and then there's like seven others in the past like 5 years or whatever.
Totally. Yeah, it's really funny. Like I say, you can check the Hollywood Reporter today. It's a pretty funny article about it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It's kind of the bane of horror movies, is trying to come up with an ominous title, and it's either come up with something long, like Don't Torture a Duckling, or Let's Scare Jessica to Death, or it's going to be something that's like one word.
Right.
And we've kind of killed all the like, you can't just... Like, sofa isn't really going to work. all the ominous single word titles have kind of been taken. And then in some cases, like Alien, they can never be used again. So
that's right. Yeah, that's true. Like, there's some certain movies can render certain ones like off limits. But I don't feel like that had happened yet with Alone. I felt like we could go for it. But you're right. Sometimes. Yeah. Once, if it's Alien, you can't do that again.
Okay, so we're running. We're just about. Yeah, we're just about out of time, and so I know we're here for Alone, but I would kick myself if I didn't take a moment to ask about Black Summer season 2, and what can you tell us?
Well, so what I can tell you is that a great deal of season 2 takes place. It's a much more kind of sprawling story, time wise. There's a whole bunch of new characters and new storylines, because if you remember, the end of season 1, we're really just left with four people, and so in season 2 we have expanded the world. We also wanted to really bring the elements into it, and so that was one thing specifically, is I wanted to shoot through all seasons. So there's a great deal of this season that plays in the dead of the winter. that we play in the fall. We have, you know, monsoons. We, you know, we wanted the landscape to really become, you know, a major part of the story, because we wanted to tell a story that's dealing with survival on every level. And, you know, in many ways, it's about what happens when what happens when, you know, humanity is kind of reaching a potential new dark ages, and how close are we to getting out of that, or are we just at the beginning? And if I had references going into this season, the things that I mentioned when I was talking to the writers about what we wanted to do, I said, I want this season to be, I said three movies. I said, The Treasure of the Sierra Madre, Sorcerer, and The Thing. Those were our three kind of like,
ooh,
cinematic references. And
it's an eclectic mix.
Yes, it's an eclectic mix, but they all are dealing with kind of, they all are in one way or the another about survival, but not necessarily, in many parts, survival of elements, and in other ways, survival of the human beings being your greatest enemy as well. And I think this year is probably a little bigger. It's a little more sprawling. It's got some even more kind of crazy action, but it's also, I think what we try to do in season one, and we try to do this season two, is have every episode be a different thing. So there, you know, that we'll have certain episodes that are, you know, real kind of character pieces. We have a great one that's just kind of a two-hander. We have one that's kind of a psychological horror, and then we have some that are just out and out like battles from start to finish. So I think we upped the ante from season one, both from a story perspective and I think from a filmmaking perspective too. You know, we definitely tried to be really ambitious in what we're doing, and I'm pretty excited about it. I think it's the most challenging thing I've ever done, and I'm really proud of what we've come up with so far. Two more weeks.
Do we have the same characters or new characters? How is that?
Well, we have the surviving characters from season one are here, but there's a very big cast of characters, of new characters. So we kind of loaded up with new faces, and definitely not everyone is going to make it. Let's put it this way. Most everyone is not going to make it.
That's one of the things I loved about the first season, was that there are characters that died in like a minute. It was
just, yeah,
like you had thought that was going to be the lead character. Nope, they're gone.
Yeah, that's so we continued that through, and even of our main characters from last season, they don't all make it either.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Nice. My final questions somewhat related to that, but I just want to make a statement on your film. During the pandemic, I do a lot of walks in the forest with my dog, and I'll pass a young woman, you know, walking her dog, or
just driving bad.
Well, or driving down a dirt road, and you see a woman jogging, a pretty woman jogging, whatever. This film, unfortunately, makes my concerns of those women that I pass in the forest, which is why are they here? Because unfortunately, what your film shows is the danger that a young, attractive woman just traveling from one state to another state may unfortunately get into, and I feel terrible about that, and that is how society is, and I guess my question is, were you trying to make that feeling be the main point of the movie, rather than just making it the thrill that some folks may see it? as a commentary on the danger that one gender has in the world that they shouldn't have.
Well, yeah, I think it is. It's something that even though it's been presented many times in movies, it's something that is worthy of examination. Oh, I'm sorry about that. It's something worthy of examination because I know for myself that I've been, you know, at night walking and there's a woman on the side of the street. I remember this distinctly when I was in college, even walking down the street and it's late at night and there's a woman coming towards me and seeing her cross to the other side and realizing that I am so sorry, guys.
No worries.
That's my kids coming. One second. And just seeing that fear that people have, that a woman has just by any male that is potentially a threat. And we should all be very aware of that. We should, it's incredibly unfortunate, but that is something that all men need to put themselves into the mindset of what women feel just by seeing us, just by riding an elevator with a man, and that you can, you know, that any man is potentially a threat. And it's not necessarily because men are physically stronger than women. It's just because men actually have, you know, certainly a lot of men go through life feeling that it's okay to look at women a certain way when they're alone with them. That somehow deep in their mind they've got this twisted concept in their mind that they've got a shot with anybody, and that a woman, you know, that their attention is deserved. Instead of treating a woman with the respect that you treat anyone else, you wouldn't do that to a guy. So why would you do that to a woman? So I think those things that exist in our culture still exist, and it's disturbing, and it's something that we should evolve. And so it's taking that trope, it's taking that idea and dealing with it in a thriller setting. But it's something I've always been very aware of. And like I say, I have, I've got two daughters, I've got a wife, and I think about this world that they're living in and the threats that they have to deal with that the average man doesn't have to deal with. And so, yeah, I think that is all true.
Now, Mike, what's that question you wanted to ask him? Oh, sorry. Was that your?
Well, okay. So
no, I was just going to say, it sounds like we need to let him go.
Yeah. Well, this is the wrap-up question that Mike wanted to ask.
Yeah, so my question is this, is when Black Summer Season 2 comes out, will you consider coming back on the podcast?
Absolutely. Anytime, guys.
All right, that would be fantastic. Thank you.
Yeah.
Great. Oh, so great. Well, this was so great. Thank you for coming on.
Well, thank you so much. It was a lot of fun talking to you guys. And yeah, I'll be happy to. Black Summer will be coming out early next year, and we'll do it again.
And anything you wanted to promote or where people can find you on social media or anything like that to help you out?
Well, I'm not worried about that. Just watch the movie alone, you know, and I mean, I am on social. I don't really do much on social media, to be honest with you. I go in there from time to time, but no, I just, more important, just find the movie. It's playing at drive-ins across, it's at 50 drive-ins across the country on top of theaters, which is, it's a great drive-in movie, I think. And it's been doing really well at those, funny enough. Which is kind of an interesting byproduct of the pandemic. And somehow, you know, the movie has managed to reach people. It's been doing really, surprisingly well for Magnolia in its theatrical release and on-demand release. I think it's something about it seems to be speaking to people right now, but it's still out there, and we'd love as many people to see it as possible.
Well, I was just texting with my sister about this while you were talking and telling her some things you were saying, and she just rented it right now on Amazon. Oh, so she's awesome. Watching it this minute. She's like, awesome. I just popped popcorn. I'm doing this right now. I'm like, okay, cool. I'll tell him.
I love it. Thank you. Thank your sister.
And my wife actually just gave me her review. She said she liked it. She was upstairs watching it while we were doing this.
Oh, yeah. Nice. All right. Yeah. Good. Glad to hear it. Well, I am thrilled when I read reviews from women critics and in general, just because I want, it's important to me that they watch this and don't think, oh, it's the same old, dumb character walking into stupid situations. So I'm always pleased when the women I've talked to or have written about it who say, she actually makes intelligent decisions. And some ways that's what's scary about it, is that she does the things you want her to do and still she's in for it. But so I'm happy to hear it if women can respond as well as men.
Yeah, my wife actually loved the movie too. She was the one that chose it for our movie night.
So. Oh, that's awesome. That's awesome.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks again. We really appreciate it, and hopefully more people will definitely see your film. And we'll let you go because I know you got to call back one of your daughters.
That's who it is, actually. So I gotta, and I didn't disengage it from my computer. I really apologize for that, but I gotta call them.
No worries.
All right. Thank you guys so much.
Yep. Thank you.
Have a great day.
All right. Bye. Cheers.
Bye-bye. Cheers.
Bye.
Cheers.
Bye.
All right, so we'll thank our director for joining us, and that was a fun time. Again, we actually didn't know who we were directing until that early morning that he actually was more well known, prolific than we thought. So that was kind of cool. I think he answered a lot of stuff that we were curious about. Never mind me and Mike's interest in Black Summer and getting a little sneak peek on that too.
Will he come back to talk about Black Summer season 2? You're gonna have to listen to the interview to find out.
It's true. All right. So I guess we give our final thoughts on this film here. But before we do that, Eric, you actually do another podcast for Buddy Dan.
I do. It is a general interest podcast called The Askancy Podcast. That's spelled Askancity. You can find it wherever you got this one.
Excellent. And Mike, by the time people listen to this, we just wrapped up a podcast.
We did wrap up a podcast. That podcast is a travel guide to Lovecraft Country, which is about the HBO 10-episode season, or perhaps series. There's been no word on whether or not there'll be a second series or a second season. I have a funny feeling there won't be a second season of the Travel Guide to Lovecraft Country podcast, based on the opinions of some members of that podcast towards the show. Nevertheless, the show is out there. If you want to hear what we have to say about it.
Yes.
You can tune into that. What was that, Eric?
Particularly the one that came up with the idea for doing the show in the first place.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other matter.
Indeed. We'll let that go. All right, so let's give our final thoughts on this movie here. And why don't you start, Chrissy?
Well, I definitely think that if you are a fan of the cat and mouse type of genre, style or genre, whatever subgenre, you'll enjoy this. This movie does have a lot more to say than a typical cat and mouse film. It does talk about aloneness. It does talk about identity. It does talk about what we really know and what we don't about others in our lives. It's also a big comment on, the five stages of grief. And it's a very internal film as well as external. I think it's well done. And I, highly recommend it. If you can see it at a drive-in, that would be a blast. I'm so thrilled to see drive-ins come back a little bit because of this pandemic. It's just nice to see. But if you need to rent it online just to watch it at home, definitely do so. And it's a really fun ride. And I know my sister rented it right as I was on the interview with the director. Actually, I texted her. She rented it and she loved it too. And she, unlike me, is a very big fan of cat and mouse films. So she's seen them all pretty much. So she really liked this one and thought it was a standout. So I totally recommend it. See it.
All right, very good. Mike.
Yeah. I'm not going to lie. I'm not going to say this movie completely blew me away or it's top 10 film for the year for me. But I think it is a solid thriller, or cat and mouse film or woman in danger film or however you want to categorize it. It doesn't do a lot new, but it does a really good job of execution. I think in the final act, they do a really good job of putting you in the place of the lead actress, of the lead character. I think they do a good job of getting some good adrenaline going in the fights because of the way that they're filmed. You know, these are not overly stylized. It's not The Matrix or John Wick or any other movie starring Keanu Reeves where he kicks people in the face. But I just think it's just fundamentally well executed. And I really do want to thank the director for giving us his time, because that was a fantastic little interview he gave us. He gave us a lot of good insight, and he is the best kind of interview, because you ask him a question and he just would go and give us a whole lot of stuff that tells you he really thought about these things, and had a lot to say. So again, thumbs up, recommended.
All right. Very good. For me, this was a really solid film. I enjoyed it a whole lot. Original or not, it was suspenseful. Had both me and my wife on our tippy toes in suspense. It was really entertaining, kept my attention, and it never really dragged. And so it was a really top thriller, and it does deserve its 93% good reviews on Rotten Tomatoes, where it's actually being reviewed by major publications, not just bloggers. Big thumbs up for me. And want to thank the director once more for joining us. That was greatly appreciated and definitely fun. Eric?
I generally echo all those sentiments from Phil and Mike and Chrissy. And I also just want to say, go buy a ticket to the drive and go spend the money for the digital renter. Spend your money on this good movie so we get more good movies. You cheap bastards. Spend your money. Do it.
Do it. All right. So once again, this is Alone 2020 film. It is available wherever VOD is rented on pretty much all the platforms. Directed by John Hyams, the showrunner of Black Summer, which everybody should also check out on Netflix, especially if you like zombies. Starring Jules Wilcox. That was a great story how he found her, as he discussed in the interview. Mark Menchaca, star of season one of Ozark, and Anthony Hild, a well-known character actor and someone that, as Mike mentioned in the interview, he has always enjoyed. So check it out. And with all that stated, Eric, why don't you lead us out?
All right. Thanks for tuning in and listening to us discuss the movie Alone. Now, please enjoy our interview with the director. Thank you.